All right, you're live.
Great, thank you. I'd like to call to order the Hood River City Council meeting of March 8th, 2021. It is 6 p.m. And before we start our meeting, I want to do a couple things. I want to acknowledge the land that we all live on. As we meet tonight, let us all remember today that we are stewards of land that has been home to indigenous peoples for thousands of years before the recent arrival of the European heritage dominant culture. We honor this land's ancestors as we go about our business today. And I'd also like to do the Pledge of Allegiance. I don't know if you have a flag for us, Jonathan. All right. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. All right. We have a couple speakers, but we're going to do business from the audience, and I have one person signed up for business from the audience this evening. And that is Susan Crowley to speak on public hearings on Zoom. Susan, you'll have 3 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Good evening. This is Susan Crowley, 411 12th Street, Hood River. And I wanted to make a general request for a favor, actually. When we testify in other matters, and I've done it maybe in front of state hearing groups and judicial matters, you often have your actual face showing, which is really a nice addition, because the one thing Zoom does for us during this time is it lets our faces show to one another. And when you're communicating or trying to communicate with other folks, it's really nice to have a kind of face-to-face contact, or at least the best we can do with it these days. And it seems like it should be possible technically to allow people to join the Zoom meeting so that you can actually see us and then actually see us while we're testifying. So that would be a nice personal gesture, and also would help it feel more like a real public hearing. The other thing is that one of the advantages of public gatherings and public meetings is that you can see other people testifying, and that would be a help too. You can also see who's at the meeting, who's at the hearing, and that's a useful thing. That's an important part of public gatherings generally. So I wonder if you could check with Jonathan and see if that's at all possible. Most of the time you will not be swamped with people, and we're all used to navigating multiple screens, and perhaps you can set it up so you guys are always at the top. And that would be a tremendous help in terms of making these difficult times, feel more normal. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Susan. All right. We have several other people signed up to speak, but they all want to speak at the public hearing portion. So we'll go ahead on to our presentations this evening. And Rachel is going to introduce our speakers this evening.
Great. Thank you, Mayor. I'm going to introduce both speakers. And what I thought I would suggest respectfully is that Elisa speak first. She can take some questions, and then Kenny LaPointe will speak next, and then there may be an opportunity for both of them to answer questions, but I'll defer to you, Mayor, for how you'd like to handle it. So first, Elise Fowler is the social worker hired by the city as a contractor to provide outreach to our homeless population this winter. She is a licensed clinical social worker and has been working in the Mid-Columbia region since 2017. She has 2 decades of professional, educational, and volunteer experience as a therapist and service provider specializing in mental health and housing, with a commitment to the model of housing as healthcare. Elisa is now employed with Mid-Columbia Community Action Council as the Housing Stabilization Manager. And Kenny LaPointe is the newly hired Executive Director for the Mid-Columbia Community Action Council. He came to the region from Oregon Housing and Community Services, the state of Oregon's housing finance agency, where he served as the Public Affairs Director for 5 years. Prior to his service with the state of Oregon, he spent 6 years as the Housing and Resident Services Director for Housing Works, the Central Oregon Regional Housing Authority. Kenny also served for over 3 years as a home ownership counselor for Neighbor Impact, Central Oregon's community action agency. Other prior service includes co-chair of Central Oregon's Homeless Leadership Coalition, the region's Continuum of Care, a member of the City of Bend's Affordable Housing Committee, president of the Cascade chapter of NAHRO, National Association of Housing Redevelopment Officials, Neighborhood Partnerships Board of Directors, member of the Community Advisory Council for Central Oregon's Coordinated Care Organization, and one of the founding members of Icon City, a Central Oregon nonprofit organization. We are really fortunate to have both Elisa and Kenny as members of our community providing these important services. And with that, I'll turn it over to Elisa.
Hello, thank you everyone. Great to see so many faces that I know from the work that I've done previously with the Hood River Homeless Task Force, and I am very grateful for this time to present on this project today. And also thank you, Rachel, for that introduction. I am going to share my screen and briefly share some slides about my project with Gorge Outreach, and then I will, as Rachel said, answer some questions, and then it will lead right into the work that Kenny is now doing in our region. So let me pop over to that. And you may see my dog in the background. He's part of all of my presentations, as people who have met me know already. Are you guys seeing my my PowerPoint? Wonderful. Okay. Great, thank you everyone. So this project, I began contracting with the city of Hood River at the beginning of our winter warming shelter season. And I meet weekly with Rachel and both chiefs, Leonard, Damien, and Neil Holst. I do that for a check-in on needs that are identified from their end as a first responder, and also to give them feedback about needs that I'm seeing out in our houseless community. So now we will see if it works. Ta-da. Oh, wonderful. Yeah. So the Hood River County Mobile Outreach Program is a street outreach and case management program. I am an LCSW, but the focus of this work is direct linkage to existing services and gathering information from people experiencing houselessness on barriers and helping them navigate with into the resources that are available, while also collecting information on some community needs. So it's both doing paperwork and coordination, and also loading up my Subaru and filling it up with just like the basic things to help people be as comfortable as possible, which during COVID era, with a lack of other resources, something like some hot cocoa and soup and some warm socks. And as you can see, sleeping bag donated from our partners at Hood River Shelter Services can really make a difference to help people get stabilized enough to take the next steps on their housing journey. For those of you that haven't been to the Hood River Pallet Shelter site, you can see that in the background. They are a wonderful community partner for us. And we work together with them. I go there once a week to meet with their participants, and as well as actually going out to meet people by referral and to go to camps where people are staying or in their RVs or other places. Some just general demographic information, because sometimes people wonder about an overview of numbers. We don't have perfect information on how many people are experiencing houselessness and sleeping outside in our community. Point in time count had historically given us a snapshot, We didn't do that this year because of COVID safety, so our numbers are a little bit older, but you can see in general, Hood River Shelter Services served about 94 individuals in the 2019-2020 year. I think that's an undercount. It doesn't count our folks that maybe are staying on an RV with no utilities out on somebody's property, or people that are doubled up, or people that might have somewhere to stay for a little bit and then move on, or staying in campgrounds. But that's the information that our federal government has as sort of a snapshot. So all the people that I worked with through this contract met the HUD definition, the federal definition of homelessness, which meant they were either staying outside in a tent or sleeping on the street in a vehicle or some other place not meant for habitation, or doubled up folks were also eligible. So staying with family and friends, but not permanently and not on the lease, although I haven't been getting as much communication from those people. Okay. And the objectives that I am working on with this program were built from the recommendations of the Hood River Homeless Task Force. So I wanted to meet as many as possible through this contract. There's more recommendations from that document with the ongoing strategic planning, but what I thought would be most useful during this winter time would be assisting our individuals and families to identify and address barriers to housing placement. And for a lot of people during COVID, that really looks like some basic things like helping them get scheduled at the DMV. DMV appointments are pretty impacted. You can't apply for housing, even if you have employment, if you don't have an ID. So, and also our mobile outreach served as a referral source to our first responders. They could reach out to me. I wasn't on call 24/7 like our first responders, but they could email me or meet in that coordination meeting if they had someone they were especially concerned about getting linked in. And also, I did a lot of outreach to meet with our other providers and learn about, like in person or on the phone and through Zoom, what resources they had, because our social service networks are constantly shifting, especially during COVID. So that was really important to be able to figure out what resources we do have available. And I had the opportunity to partner with community volunteers, such as our friends at the Riverside Church's hospitality site, and go and do some introductions for local resources. And they would call me in to assist folks with case management, as well as our friends at the Hood River Shelter. And the final part of this project, once I wrap up, also includes feedback. Community-based participatory research is a fancy way of saying I'm talking to all the folks that are outside and getting their testimony and identifying a little bit about their narrative about what is happening for them as they're experiencing houselessness in our community. I have my own ideas as a provider, but it's been really helpful to be able to take the time and hear from them what barriers and needs they're identifying. So, I just had to go right to the turkey. This is my dog, Bodie. We got a really wonderful donation from Riverside to be able to go out to meet our folks where they were at and let them have a Thanksgiving dinner. One of the needs that our people who are outside are really feeling during COVID is a lot of community meal programs aren't as accessible as they used to be, or require that you have, like Meals on Wheels has done an amazing job getting out there and supporting our elders and other people during COVID. But if you don't have a hotel room or an address, you can't access that. So it was special to be able to go out and bring people hot food on both Thanksgiving and Christmas. And for our demographics, I served 40 distinct individuals, 39 were adults, and the remaining were children under 18. So I don't have the exact household number. It's a combination of single adults, families with children, and families without children that will be included in my final report. Pretty similar to other demographics in my previous hotel outreach program. The Native community was definitely overrepresented. You can see here about 16% of the people served identify as Native or Alaska Native. and our Latino community was still underserved despite many efforts I made in planning to reach out on the front end. So that's something I included in my recommendations, is making sure that all outreach programs are partnering with culturally specific providers as much as possible. So that way the people that are being served is actually at parity or above what we see in our census information. So, and I talk about that a little bit more here. I did partner with our agencies that are doing more of the culturally specific services, such as the Next Door, and was able to attend different coordination groups through Natives on the Big River weekly coordination meeting, and also do some outreach to different sites along with some of those people doing work with community advocates and tribal health authorities. So that was a great opportunity for this program. And I'd recommend that any outreach that continues in this community moving forward can also build on those relationships and community groups. The main things that were talked about by the people who were receiving services from me about the impact, especially during COVID, that we, you know, our community providers are working on but haven't necessarily met this need yet, was around showers and laundry facilities. There is a volunteer group now doing some laundry access once a week, which is wonderful, but there's not a lot of places open in our community where people can take showers. And that didn't used to be the case pre-COVID. And it's really been a public health and just comfort issue for our folks that are outside. Also, I'm hearing a lot about transportation is more challenging than it used to be, although of course CAT and Link are still available. It's harder in an area that was already impacted in terms of public transportation. And many people don't have stable mailing addresses. So working on a plan to address that, because most housing processes in our region require that you have your housing application to be mailed to you, paper in person. So if you want to stay up to date on that process, you need somewhere to mail. And a few people, when I asked them why they weren't accessing the Hood River shelter, reported that it wasn't accessible for them because, of course, a lot of people have jobs that are shift work and they're working after hours, and the intake hours are currently around 5 to 8, although the shelter will partner with people who are working and make accommodations for them. And I did pass that message on. For some people, the combination of transportation and the hours made it very hard to access shelter, which is understandable. If you're working until midnight or 2, you don't want to go to the shelter and stay until 5 or 6 in the morning. It's more comfortable to stay at a campsite unless it's an emergency weather situation. So, yeah. And in terms of a lot of housing placement, assistance and outcomes are still in process. Everyone that I have contacted has been offered the opportunity to apply for housing choice vouchers and also to be linked to Bridges to Health. Not everyone has agreed, and some of them are already in process. So I'm hoping to have more outcomes soon. Three households did receive their non-elderly disabled priority housing vouchers for people who are experiencing homelessness. So that's pretty exciting, because that's just almost the last step before getting into that ongoing assisted or subsidized housing. And really the flexibility of this program has helped. I was able to give gas vouchers to one family to help the kids go to school, minor car repairs, just things that come up that are day-to-day that can completely shut things down for people and make a minor emergency into a major emergency. I could bridge people while they get linked to more ongoing services. So, and during our sort of surprise winter weather event too, I was really fortunate to be able to coordinate with our first responders and also Gorge Ecumenical Ministries, who did the emergency hotel voucher program, to get a lot of people access to that resource, which was just so important. If you all remember, there were some nights, I think it was down to 19 degrees, and I encountered a family that had been planning to sleep in their car because their RV, they couldn't get to their RV. You know, that sort of situation where people may have had a resource but were unable to access it because they didn't have the right transportation. So I'm very glad that family and their kids got to be inside during that time period and are working on next steps now. There's a demo, that is my disaster blanket supply with all of the snow on it. And yeah, I think next steps for this project are putting together our final demographics and the participant feedback, and all of that will be submitted to the city at the end as a deliverable, and making sure that I review with all my participants that they've all been referred to available resources. And I think I can pretty much let Kenny go on to the next steps, because through my role now with, I've recently, within the last 2 weeks, started working with Kenny as Mid-Columbia Community Action's Housing Stabilization Manager. And there's a lot of opportunities coming up through MCAC around it, all of the goals that I'd outlined before for making sure we have robust street outreach and centralized access to available resources, and getting much better data on who is experiencing homelessness and, you know, what their needs are back to the community. So that is my, make sure I'm not missing any more important pictures there. Once again, is Bodie. We filled that Subaru up and emptied it many times during this project in order to get as many both informational and basic needs resources out to our community. So thank you, everybody. And I am ready for questions.
Thank you, Alyssa. That was fantastic. That was amazing work you did this winter. Does anyone have questions? Kenny may go into some of the things that we may ask Alyssa too. So if you have any quick questions for Alyssa, and then we'll go with Kenny's presentation. Anyone? Gladys has something.
Hi, thank you. I do have a question for you. First of all, thank you for all the work that you've done. Overall, did people feel, those that you were serving, did they feel better connected to the existing services here in the Gorge? Can you just tell us a little bit more about that?
I believe that they did. You know, I didn't put this in my bio, but I've been volunteering with Hood River Shelter Services for a couple of years, and I also did some volunteer work out in, I live in Wasco, and I do some work in the Dalles as well, volunteer-wise. And, you know, previously when I was out doing homeless events, I would ask people, are you on a waiting list? Are you working with a housing case manager? I'd say 50-50. People would be working with somebody, and that was a really low number to me, because my experience has come from Washington County and Portland Metro, where when you're out on the street and you're engaging people in conversations about their housing plans, 80 to 90% of people are like, yeah, I'm working with TPI, I'm working with this person, I'm just on this list. But our community here, when I first started going out and talking to people, I realized they had never had a social worker necessarily come to them and start talking to them. So they were a little confused. They maybe had experienced someone from a faith group or a volunteer group come out and provide them with soup or socks or blankets, but a lot of them had not been engaged in their camps and out on the street with that conversation. So I see a huge improvement, and that's not just my project with Gorge Outreach. I think it's also regionally other providers, including like the Next Door and MCAC's like SFEF program, are going out and really seeking people out that are for whatever reason not engaging. So,
anyone else? We may have questions after Kenny's presentation too. Thank you, Alyssa.
Great, thank you, Karen McBride.
Go ahead, Kenny. You're up.
Great, can you all hear me okay? All right, I'm gonna share my screen and show you some more acronyms. So thank you, Mayor McBride and members of the council. I appreciate the opportunity to be here tonight. My name's Kenny LaPointe. I'm the new executive director, I think, like 115 days on the job, but who's counting? So I've been with the Columbia Community Action since November of last year. And as was mentioned before, I previously was the Public Affairs Director for Oregon Housing and Community Services, the state housing finance agency. And you know, our primary funder as Mid-Columbia Community Action Council. Mid-Columbia Community Action Council is your community action agency serving Hood River, Wasco, and Sherman counties. We really focus right now, I'll say right now, because I think we have a lot of opportunity ahead of us, but we focus on providing shelter, housing assistance, utility bill pay assistance, and weatherization assistance to the three county areas that we serve. Here's just a quick list of our board members, and I believe you got this in advance, so you do have a copy of it as well, so forgive me if I kind of run through it a little bit quick. So I mentioned our core program areas, which I'll dive into here. So shelter operations is really a new thing for Mid-Columbia Community Action Council. In fact, I would say when I came to the region in November, I had no intention of running the Dalles shelter site. I actually said in my head that I'm not going to do that right now and wait and see what the organization needs from an infrastructure standpoint before I took that on. Well, that didn't happen. On Christmas Eve, the city of the Dalles contacted me and asked me if I would take over, Mid-Columbia Community Action would take over the non-congregate pallet shelter site. Same type of structure that we have in Hood River as well. I told the city I would think about it, and then we ended up coming to an agreement a little later on in January that Mid-Columbia Community Action would take over that site. I will talk a little bit more about that in a little bit in a moment here, but we do run the site in the Dalles on behalf of the community there. Obviously, there's the Hood River. Hood River Shelter Services runs the 13 non-congregate sites in Hood River. Mid-Columbia Community Action does assist with providing funding for that shelter from an operations standpoint. And then, this winter time, the first thing that I wanted to do coming into the position is make sure that we did have a solid shelter strategy, in particular for the winter season. And so we assisted in funding both the Hood River and the Dalles shelters, including purchasing some of the pallet shelters at the Dalles site. And then we also have funded hotel and motel vouchers in both Hood River and Wasco counties. So Gorge Ecumenical Ministries is helping to administer the hotel motel voucher program in Hood River County. And then St. Vincent de Paul of the Dalles is administering the hotel motel voucher program for Wasco and Sherman counties. Here's the sites. I think you all have probably seen the Hood River shelter sites. And I always like to say this, but it's kind of obvious here. There is nothing about these shelters that is made of pallets. So I don't know about the pallet shelter site name. It sounds more like a Pinterest project that my wife wants me to do, and it's not. These are very nice little structures that give folks safe shelter during the tough winter months and hopefully year round in the future here. As mentioned before, both our agency and Hood River Shelter Services operate these sites. So the Dalles shelter site, which I'll focus on momentarily here. As I mentioned, we took this site over in November. We came to an agreement with the city that we would operate the site in exchange for a little bit of a longer term commitment on the actual use of the site. So we have a 3-year agreement with the city to provide utilization of the site. That agreement is able to be extended at our discretion up to an additional 3 years beyond the first 3-year term. The city of the Dalles is also paying for the porta potties to be serviced, as well as the electric utility that they paid to put in from an infrastructure standpoint. That utility serves each of these units. And then the city also agreed to put in sewer and water on the site, which was really important because we recently purchased a shower/restroom trailer that is ADA compliant, has three showers in it and three restrooms. And we plan to put that on the site when it is delivered, which is supposed to be delivered in June of this year.
And then that would allow the residents or the guests of the shelter to have access to shower facilities as well as restrooms. And as Lisa mentioned earlier on, having access to showers is a very critical need right now, especially since many of the public facilities that folks used to rely on to take showers at have been shut down due to COVID. So we're really excited that we're going to be able to bring this into the community. We also anticipate in the future that the shower trailer will be able to serve as outreach across the region. We would really love to have a second trailer that we could, so we could have one in the Dalles and one in Hood River serving all three of the counties. But we also envision
that if we are in, when we are in another wildfire related situation, we could use the shower trailer to provide showers to wildland firefighters as well as residents who may be displaced.
I will also say that the City of the Dalles is currently
evaluating the long-term operations of the shelter site in the Dalles. We've had really good success in the community. The Chief of Police states that there's been a significant reduction in police calls in the downtown core. And is the police department is seeing a lot better interactions with folks who are experiencing houselessness in the community. And we've also been able to place a number of folks from the shelter site into more permanent housing situations, which is great. In fact, in the last 3 weeks or a couple of weeks, we've had three folks who've been able to be placed in permanent housing. And some
of those are receiving those non-elderly
mainstream disabled vouchers that Lisa talked about earlier. So the city is evaluating the long term. They're evaluating whether or not they're going to allow the shelter to be operated year round. So we expect that City Council is going to be bringing that to discussion on March 22nd. We're scheduled to close the shelter site on March 31st. So we're eagerly awaiting what's going to happen following that council meeting. These are a few of the other areas that we focus our housing programs on. So rapid
rehousing, really helping folks get back into housing as quick as possible, making sure that their homelessness is very, very brief.
We know that folks, the longer folks experience homelessness, the more difficult it becomes and more likely they are to have long-term complex issues that are associated with that episode. In addition, we provide homeless prevention resources. So we help folks who have had a financial setback. Maybe they've had a huge medical bill. They've lost their job, but have something on the way. We help those folks stay in their homes by providing some rental assistance for them. And we've done a lot of that through COVID-related funding over the last year or so. And then we also work on doing street
outreach. We have a supportive services through the
For Veterans Families Program, where we do street outreach. And,
you know, we're super lucky to have Alyssa join us and be helping head up our housing team and really take a good look at what we're doing from a street outreach standpoint. We'll talk a little bit more later on what that's going to look like.
Here's the demographic detail for our
services and our housing program. I will note that these are the numbers for 2020. From my standpoint, our office in Hood River, which many of you probably know is in the Columbia River Insurance Building,
we have a small office space there. We have not had a full-time housing person stationed in that office, and we have changed that up within the last month or so. So we now have a full-time bilingual housing staff person that is working in the Hood River office. So we anticipate that that will result in more partnership opportunities
and more clients served in Hood River,
and we do plan to expand on that here in the future. But these are our service
numbers from 2020.
I will also highlight for the right here that
we have partnered with the Mid-Columbia Housing Authority to get nearly $1.5 million in COVID-related rental assistance out to the community. We do have a program out there right now called the STAR program, or supporting tenants accessing rental resources. We have around nearly $500,000 that is available right now for households that have been impacted by COVID to help prevent them from losing their home. So I will show our office number later on, and you're welcome to refer folks to us who may think we need assistance there. So the other program area, this used to be really called energy assistance, and we kind of retitled it as utility bill pay assistance because we're doing work across many different utilities, but we assist low-income households with paying their heating and cooling bills and other energy and utility bills that they may be incurring. We work a lot in partnership with the electric cooperatives as well as with the city of Hood River. So we've got a great partnership with the city, and we've been running a water and sewer program with the city of Hood River, which has been great for our clients. It provides folks with a 40% discount on city water and a 30% discount on sewer. And in 2020, we were able to serve 49 households with that program. We are currently working on a pretty similar program with the city that would provide a stipend to households where their monthly utility costs are rolled into their rental payments. And we recognize that those folks are paying for utilities, but they're paying it just as an added amount to their rental costs. And so this would give them a stipend that would be applied towards other utility bills, such as Pacific Power, their Pacific Power bill. So that is sort of an expansion. Our agency will serve to do eligibility and intake for that program. And we served 914 households in 2020. We've had a greater presence in Hood River County with our utility bill payment assistance programs because we have had staff full-time that have been stationed in our Hood River office. And in addition, we provided over 300,000 in COVID-related utility assistance for households. Weatherization programming is the smallest of our programs, but definitely has a very large impact. This program really is looking at folks who are served by our energy programs, our utility bill pay programs. And when we notice that there may be some inefficiency from an energy and utility standpoint, we are able to refer folks to our weatherization program and then go into their homes and provide them with an array of energy and utility upgrades that will make their homes more energy efficient, thus reducing their long-term energy usage. So that is really the priority of that program, is to reduce the long-term energy costs for households. And you see here, we served five households in Hood River County in 2020. We are seeing a big uptick in folks utilizing this program as we're starting to market it much more significantly. But we're able to do a lot of various upgrades to homes, like replacing windows, furnaces, doing new insulation. Often when we're doing manufactured homes, we'll have to do floor replacement. So we're doing an array of large costs, large ticket items for households. So I highlighted here a few areas of opportunity that I see for us. So I mentioned kind of the work that's going on around the shelter site in the Dalles. I think there's a lot of opportunity in finding another shelter site in the future in Hood River, especially as there's, we're hoping, crossing our fingers, that I believe it's House Bill 2006 will be passed that continues to expand on the flexible shelter siting legislation. We also, the agency is going through strategic planning right now, so we're really rethinking and re-envisioning who we are as an agency and how we serve the community. We've gone through one session. We haven't gone through programmatic prioritization yet, but we envision that equity is going to be a huge part of our work moving forward. And we did a number of partner interviews, partner and stakeholder interviews, as
as we prepared for strategic planning. And it was really highlighted that the community would like to see our agency lead partnership development, help coordinate folks and collaborate, and then make sure that the region knows about the resources that are available. I mentioned the increase in staffing in our Hood River office. So we're continuing to staff up. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second, but I will make a shameless pitch that we are somewhat looking for new office space in Hood River County because our office is not suitable for the work that we're doing and the expansion that we're looking at. So if anyone has any ideas, I'm happy to take them, and I'll show my contact information in a little bit here. But we're definitely looking for a new site opportunity in the area, and we're also talking with Hood River Shelter Services about what opportunities might exist to co-locate the shelter as well as the homeless service programs that we provide at our agency. I mentioned the Hood River Water and Sewer Program that we're partnering on, so we're sort of in the final stages of development right now with the great staff at the city. The other area I want to highlight is permanent supportive housing. So permanent supportive housing is housing that has services tied to it that is really designed to serve folks who are coming out of homelessness. It helps provide the services that they need to become stable in housing. I have a background in permanent supportive housing and wrote the state's legislation or governor's policy agenda around permanent supportive housing a few years back, which was funded through the governor's agenda. And we are looking to take advantage of some of the resources that are available out there. So we would love to hear about opportunities for supportive housing development where Mid-Columbia Community Action might be able to be the service provider, may be able to jointly provide services with a housing developer such as the Mid-Columbia Housing Authority, who is a strong partner of ours. We are looking at doing our own permanent supportive housing development right now in the Dalles, and are hoping to put in an application for 40 units of permanent supportive housing in that area on a site that we currently own that is serving homeless veterans. So we hope to expand services to homeless veterans on that site. A couple of different programs that
we have going on. So we've got the STAR program, supporting tenants accessing rent relief that I mentioned before. We've got an emergency rent assistance program that's going to be launched in the coming weeks. We anticipate that we will be receiving around $3 million for the region to provide rental assistance to households who have been impacted by COVID, and that will be through a partnership with the Housing Authority. And then one of the other things I want to mention here is this Emergency Solutions Grant, or ESG, Coronavirus 2. Mid-Columbia Community Action pulled together multiple partners in the region, including the Nextdoor, Nichiwana, the Mid-Columbia Housing Authority, Hood River Shelter Services, the Oregon Human Development Corporation, trying to think of who else. Also includes the Dalles shelter site. But we were notified last week that our application was the top scoring application in the Rural Oregon Continuum of Care. And we were asked to come back in and ask for more money than we requested. So we are working with all the partners right now to put together a beefed up budget, and we're hoping that we can get $2 million+ in homeless service funding that would really fund our shelter system, as well as homeless prevention and rapid rehousing, and a strong, solid street outreach team that would really be working with communities of color, with folks living on the Native American sites along the Columbia River. So we're hoping that we're pretty confident here that we're going to get over $2 million in resources to help fund a variety of programs across the region that are very coordinated. So we're excited about that. So I think I mentioned one way that I think we could help,
which has helped me find a site in Hood River that could work for a number of things. We always, can use your political support, city financial support. I think the Hood River Water and Sewer Program is a great example of that, where we have a good partnership with the city, and we're able to use our expertise in doing client intake and eligibility screening to get folks into that Hood River Water and Sewer Program. And then just telling folks about the resources that we have available. We will continue to communicate and push out press releases as well as information on programs that are available through our agency. We've been doing that a lot over the last couple of months, and we can use as much help as possible in getting that word out. And then when you have partnerships that are in front of you, think of our agency. We are here. We're here to, you know, kind of do things in a different way as an agency and serve our community in a very robust way. So think of Mid-Columbia Community Action and feel free to reach out to myself. I'm sure Lisa would be happy to have folks reach out to her as well. And here is my contact info. I've also included our main office line. So if you know of folks who are in need of assistance, that is really the phone number to go through to get that. So with that, thank you very much for having me. And I too am happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Kenny, so much. Wow. I haven't heard of Mid-Columbia Community Action taking that much action over such a short period of what did you say, 115 days for a long time. So congratulations to, thank you, and congratulations to your organization for just doing some wonderful things in a time when it's really needed. I have just a couple questions, and then other counselors may have questions too. What is the interaction between your organization and Mid-Columbia Housing Authority? That's one question. And then your interaction with people that have mental health issues. So, you know, how does that, those two things interact with your organization?
Great question. Thank you, Mayor. So we have, I would say we have a pretty strong partnership with the Mid-Columbia Housing Authority. So we have been sub-granting resources to the Housing Authority on multiple programs. I mentioned the COVID rent relief programs. I'm pretty good at identifying when we don't have an area of expertise to run something or we don't have capacity to do something. And this is one of those areas where long-term homeless prevention, rent assistance makes a lot of sense to go through the Housing Authority because they have landlord relationships that are very solid and they're paying rent on behalf of a significant number of households in the region. And so we've partnered up with them to administer the COVID rent relief program. I mentioned that federal rent assistance program that's coming that we did submit a request for information on, and we included the Housing Authority in that. So Joel and I talk on a regular basis, and I will say that before I took this job, I asked Joel if he really wanted to work with me, because I've known Joel for a number of years and had planned on partnering with the Housing Authority on a lot of our work. I see there being big advantages to partnership across community action and housing authorities, because we're doing a lot of work that's reaching a lot of the same population. So that's kind of what we have going on with the Housing Authority. On the behavioral health side, and Alisa and I have been talking a lot about this, especially related to the shelter site, we have a lot of clients, a good number of clients that are residing at our shelter in the Dalles. And I know it's true of Hood River Shelter Services, who are also receiving services through behavioral health providers. We have engaged, in fact, just a couple weeks ago, I took Dr. Gower on a tour of the Dalles shelter site because I wanted her to see what we had going on there and see the opportunities for partnership in the future. The Center for Living has committed to helping stand up a multidisciplinary team that will work with our case management staff to serve the residents of the shelter site out there.
which will be a huge win if we can wrap that deal up and have case management staff and behavioral health staff who are working out at our shelter site with those folks. We are planning, I mentioned the shower trailer, we are going to be, currently our shelter manager is utilizing an RV that her parents lent her to use to run our shelter site in the Dalles. So we will be giving her parents their RV back and grabbing another situation for that site. And we plan to have sort of like a mobile case management area where we can meet with folks in a little bit of a more confidential environment. So adding those types of infrastructure upgrades to the site will allow us to bring more partners in to provide services. Part of our funding request that I mentioned that we just found out that we got an A+ on, we include funding for community health workers, as well as additional shelter staff to support the residents of the shelter. And if we can wrap behavioral health services in there, it'll be really, really great. I would also add one more thing to this, and that is that when we do permanent supportive housing, I'll say when we do it because we are going to do it. We need partnership with behavioral health on the sites that we develop or partner in development on to provide services to the site. So we have to have a strong behavioral health partner in order to serve a population that does have complex needs that not all of our staff are super equipped to handle, and we need to have those supportive services available for folks.
Right. Thank you for all that information. That's a lot of information. Just one more question, very quick from me. The House bill that you talked about that would make the siting permanent that we did for COVID, do you know when that's going to be going through, when the question will be asked and decided on?
I know House bill, I think it's 2006. I can double check that, but I believe it's 2006. I think it was 4006 last year when it passed initially. There was a hearing on it 2 weeks ago, I believe. And I believe there was supporters from Hood River, actually, that weighed in and provided testimony on it. So I can follow up and see when it's going to go for a vote. But I think you all probably know your area representatives that probably could use a little poke to say, hey, by the way, we need some flexible shelter siting to continue in the region. There was so many folks who were testifying in support of that legislation. It was pretty unbelievable. There was they had to extend the hearing.
Great. Questions from others? Mark?
Yeah, first of all, Lisa and Kenny, thank you very much for both coming tonight and mostly for doing what you're doing. It's amazing stuff. And we do rely on you partners and teammates to help make the difference you make. So that's great. I guess my only question is, what's your sense of trends? I mean, how is the winter of 2021 compared to 1920, and I don't know if you have data for years previous to that. Are we getting better? Are we getting services to people? Are there more people? You know, just basic trend stuff.
Well, I've been here for 3 months,
so I'll let Elisa weigh in on the trends that she's been seeing.
I've been here not as long as a lot of folks, but for about 3.5 years. And I would say, as I mentioned earlier, there's a much better regional coordination. And also just the fact that we had the opportunity to do the Hood River Task Force on Homelessness, even though I know there has been some historically. I believe I was on my first task force to end homelessness in 2003. So I'm sure that some of you were as well. 10-year plan to end homelessness. This year, there's unique challenges because of COVID. A lot of the barriers that I had envisioned and system issues are different. There is less turnover among the affordable housing that we do currently have a stock for because of the eviction moratorium and prevention, which in overall is a good thing, like the work that our partnership with the Housing Authority and COVID rental assistance is keeping people in their homes, I think, that may have possibly lost them without that COVID assistance. But then that means that when my clients who are literally homeless staying in the shelter come up on the housing voucher, there is more challenges to getting them into a unit that will take their housing subsidy. So that's part of why I'm so excited to be part of Kenny's team now, because looking at opportunities for more development of affordable housing and permanent supportive housing, that's another key piece. There's the two things that I see primarily, the coordination between providers, whether it's medical, mental health, culturally specific, that's grown hugely. There's still areas for improvement, but then we need the affordable housing to link people to in those ongoing services to help them stabilize after the trauma of experiencing being unsheltered. It is extremely, extremely traumatic, and I hope there'll be some opportunities for people with more recent lived experience to share some of the challenges that they've had and what has worked for them to help them navigate out of that. Because there's some pretty great success stories happening right now. And also people who can identify what's not working even better than I can because they're living it right now.
So. I would also add that I've traveled to probably every community of this state and met with the homeless service providers and the community partners. And this region has such strong collaboration and folks who are willing to get into it and get dirty and have a little bit of fun as well. But like the partnerships are very solid. And the fact that we scored so highly on this application, says a lot about those partnerships. And we put that application in, I think I had only been here for 30 days. And the fact that I could get everybody together in a moment's notice. And when I told them we were potentially gonna get more money, they were on the phone in a moment's notice as well to talk about what that would look like. I haven't really seen that happen all over the state. So many communities struggle from a partnership standpoint. We have a lot going for us from that standpoint. And then the other thing that is data that I showed earlier is we have 190 individuals that were served in Hood River County with our housing programs. And I mentioned that we haven't had a full-time staff person, so we'll own that. That in Hood River County, there may not be as much housing services that are going to folks. But there's also a housing market. There's a lack of available housing to provide rent assistance to folks. And so if we're providing rapid rehousing assistance to households, it's easier in other areas for them to get into an affordable unit that is available for them, where it's much more difficult in Hood River because of the lack of available housing.
Does anyone else have a question? I don't see any hands. I want to make sure. Okay, I guess we don't have any additional questions. You guys were very thorough. We really are happy to hear from you and probably would like to hear an update in another year at least, but it's really encouraging, I think, to hear that there's so many partners that are collaborating so well together. And your leadership under this in coordination with all these other agencies, it sounds like good things are happening and we're able to help some people to some extent, and we'll keep continuing to collaborate with you. Really appreciate you coming to speak to us.
Thanks for having us. Really appreciate being here.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye.
That was it for our presentations this evening. Next, we have a public hearing on missing middle code. And so I've got a script that I'm gonna read. Should I go ahead with that, Dustin, now? Okay, let me get my Let me find my script. Okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to call to order a public hearing on a legislative amendment to the Hood River Zoning Code related to middle housing file number 2020-37 and ordinance 2061. Let me begin with a brief description of tonight's process and a few disclosures required by state law. First, I'll describe the order of events for each item on tonight's agenda. We will begin with a staff report in which the staff will describe the proposed amendment, the applicable approval criteria, and how the proposal is consistent with those criteria. Secondly, we will hear testimony from the public, which will happen tonight, and we will also be allowing at the March 15th City Council meeting. After that, we may discuss the draft, deliberate, and may choose to continue the hearing prior to rendering a decision. Our decision, however, is not final until it is reduced to writing and officially issued. All of our decisions are final, and when the written decision is issued, may be appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals. However, to appeal one of our decisions, you must participate either orally or in writing before the close of our record. Here are some basic rules for presenting testimony in tonight's hearing. Only present testimony in the order I just recited and do so only after being recognized as a speaker. Begin with your name. Please limit your testimony to issues that are relevant to the proposal and the approval criteria. If you believe that other or different criteria apply, please identify those and explain why you think they apply. Finally, we may set time limits on the presentation of testimony tonight, although there is no limitation on written arguments that may be submitted. It is by way of a procedural introduction for tonight's hearing. If anyone has any questions about the process as we go forward, please feel free to raise your hand and ask them during the public testimony portion of the hearing. This is regarding procedural issues. We'll go ahead and hear from the staff now with their staff report. Then we will take comments from anyone wishing to testify as part of the hearing. We will not be deliberating this evening. We may be asking questions of staff, but we will not be doing deliberations until we have heard all public testimony. All right, staff report.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a short presentation here for you to cue up some of the conversation and the testimony tonight. So with that. I'm hoping you're seeing our typical title screen. Great. Thank you. Again, good evening. Tonight, I'm going to provide an overview of the draft code and its current status. Again, the purpose of tonight's meeting is to initiate the public hearing and hear testimony from the public, as well as the opportunity to allow council to provide any questions on the draft prior to any legislative action. From our last meeting, developing the code language for missing middle housing, duplexes, triplexes, and cottages is a part of your 2020 work plan. And the purpose of the project is to establish a clear process and regulatory framework that allows greater diversity of these needed housing types that would be implemented in a standalone code for uses that were permitted outright in each of our residential zones to establish and to be reviewed under clear and objective standards through expedited review processes. In your packet, you have the legislative findings relating to 17.8, which outlines the criteria for legislative changes, which is a part of the record now. But for the audience that's joining us, possibly for the first time, I wanted to provide a little background. Middle housing has been discussed quite a bit over the past couple of years and referenced in Goal 10, which is the city's housing needs analysis, which really started looking at the need and strategy to provide some greater efficiencies on our buildable lands which is a part of the comp, is a part of our comp plan background. The project really began to take form with the completion of 2020's Echo Northwest Housing Market Report and the Hood River Housing Market FAQs, where one of the questions asked was, how can Hood River increase its housing supply to positively impact housing affordability? And the affirmative response to that, or one of the responses identified, was the development of middle housing, which is stated in the report, states that middle housing development is a key strategy for achieving a supply of units that are more affordable to more people, and that middle housing development is a mix of residential housing types where size and number of units fall between a traditional single family home and a multifamily apartment building and are compatible in the look and feel with single family detached homes. Further, it goes on to say middle housing units are generally smaller, making them more affordable than larger detached units while requiring less land than the current stock of our detached housing. From there, we began to work on our project and began to advertise out in public in our social media outlets in English and Spanish through local radio spot, where the mayor and I appeared on January 6th, through local paper coverage, media coverage, and through development of a project-specific webpage. With the development of the draft, we have conducted now 11 Council and Planning Commission public meetings, this one being number 12, and the initiation or the of the legislative council hearing. As drafted, the code included in your packet and available online outlines the expedited approval process, development standards, includes provisions for land divisions, building heights, parking rates, density, architecture, landscaping, pedestrian access, low impact development, stormwater management, tree preservation, building and site orientation, site access, housing conversions, and a certain number of development size restrictions. As listed in your packet, in kind of a procedural matter, we received notice about an issue regarding the notice and hearing dates, which is published in the paper, appeared electronically on February 16th, 20 days in advance of the hearing, but didn't appear in the physical publication of the paper until February 17th, the publication date. And that is my responsibility. I take responsibility for that notice. So as mentioned, in order to ensure that the public is given our full opportunity and full notice to participate, we have a recommendation and staff recommendation that after you take testimony, and if you choose to discuss, you leave the record open and allow testimony on March 15th prior to any action. So if you have any questions on the notice or questions on the material in the packet, I'd be happy to take them now. But I know you have a number of people who want to participate, and we received a great deal of information today. So we'd like to turn some of that over to them to make sure that they do have that opportunity to speak to council.
Thank you, Dustin. I think we'll go ahead and take public testimony. And then if we have questions, no discussion, but if we have questions of you at that point, we can ask those questions. We'll have additional time to ask questions next week on the 15th too. So we had a lot of testimony that came in late today, and so that will also give us time to read all that testimony if we weren't able to get to all of that late this afternoon. So I'm going to go ahead and let's see. We'll go ahead and take comments from anyone wishing to testify as part of the hearing. And right now I have I have 10 people that would like to speak. So if everyone could keep their comments to 3 minutes and try to get their succinct points in 3 minutes, let's go with that. The first person I have that would like to speak is David Windsor. And the second person up to speak would be Sylvan Shaw.
Am I on?
You're on, David.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to my comments here. My name is David Windsor. I'm the plant manager for Cardinal IG up in Odell. I'm responsible for 380 employees, their well-being and their financial success long-term. And I think it's still the goal of many employees to be able to afford some kind of living situation. And 75% of my staff live in Hood River County, 25% in Wasco. And a common theme I see is as people grow and move out of the house, so to speak, they really don't have anywhere to go. And that's a detriment to our community as a whole. It's a desirable place to live. People want to stay here, but they literally can't afford it. So I'm in favor of any kind of affordable housing activity. I think the middle housing makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of available land, lot sizes that can increase this housing and allow people to create the lives that they want to live here versus moving to Portland or moving out of state or wherever they want to go. The cost of housing around here has also been a huge detriment to being able to recruit effective talent. And if anything, it's also chased people out of our community to move to other Cardinal facilities where the cost of living is less. So I'm a big proponent. I'm a fan. I appreciate Dustin sharing the information a moment ago. I think it spoke to it quite well. That's all I have. Any questions?
Thank you, David. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Sylvan Shaw and then Ben Mitchell.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for the opportunity to speak tonight. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Wonderful. Thank you. So my name is Sylvan Shaw, and I'm actually testifying tonight on behalf of my friend Carlos Alvarez, who couldn't make it. He has volunteer commitments, but he's an essential worker here in town. And he's also a very essential part of our community. He's somebody who you probably all know and love from Rosars. But it's people like him who make this community a community, people who work here and raise their families here and take care of their neighbors. So Carlos says, good afternoon, council members. My name is Carlos Alvarez, and I have been a resident of Hood River for almost 21 years. I consider this lovely town to be the so-called promised land because of its people and its beauty. However, I've always thought that the cost of living and the opportunity to purchase an affordable home is almost impossible. In my time here, I have had to share a place with roommates because even to try and rent a place on your own is a true struggle for many hardworking individuals and families. I work at a local grocery store and have witnessed the need of an affordable housing solution for coworkers that are just starting out on their own journey away from the nest. So many couples work two shifts to make their monthly rent. Many people that I know live in places like Cascade Locks, Stevenson, The Dalles, and other places, but hold a job still here in Hood River. The high cost of housing is forcing them to move away. These are just a few examples, but there are many. He says, council members, with all due respect, please take into consideration that not everyone who lives in Hood River can buy a big house here. Please pass the code that will create housing for those who live here and are in a real need to stay in this beautiful town. And he says, sincerely, Carlos Alvarez, 1440 Barker Drive. And thank you so much for allowing the testimony.
Thank you, Sylvan. Ben Mitchell and then Brian Tui.
Awesome. Thank you, counselors. Some of this I mentioned last week, but Councilperson Rivera, this will be new to you, but just wanted to say thank you for taking up this absolutely critical need for workforce housing in Hood River. I've lived in Hood River for nearly the entirety of my adult life. I moved here in 2010 for a term of service in AmeriCorps. I worked as a journalist for the local newspaper for several years. I currently work in the marketing department at Mount Hood Meadows Resort, and I rent a house near 13th and Lincoln. I love my job. I love this area, and I've made many connections here, both personal and professional, but more and more, I feel like this isn't a welcoming place for me or any other individual in the working or middle class specifically those in my generation, the millennial generation, the oldest of which are now hitting 40, and even more so in Generation Z. Though my partner and I have a combined income of $100,000 a year, owning a home here still seems like a pipe dream due to the absurd and meteoric rise in home prices. No matter what progress we make, our dream of owning a home has never felt further from our grasp, as every career move and promotion we've had over the last decade has fallen short of the breakneck pace of the housing market. I seem to recall a housing study that said between 2012 and 2018, housing prices ballooned by 38% in the city of Hood River, equating to a real dollar increase of $116,000. A November 2015 article in the Oregonian noted that housing in Hood River had increased 26% since 2013, and that the median home price on Zillow was the highest it had ever been for Hood River, quoting a figure of $363,000. How quaint. Can you imagine if there was a home for sale right now for $363,000 in the city of Hood River? In 2012, that was $267,000. Now it's over half a million. How do we flatten this curve? The city's missing middle housing plan is a good start. Hood River's own housing needs analysis from 2015 shows how desperately development like this has been needed and how little there has been of affordable multifamily housing, or any affordable housing for that matter, since the analysis was published. Missing is an apt name. Sometimes I feel like real estate agencies have given up marketing to middle or working class families with ad copy for local listings touting property as Hood River getaways, second homes, and investment opportunities. What about first homes for families, teachers, and workers who labor in the breweries and orchards our area is famous for? We may fatalistically chalk it up to the invisible hand of the free market, but what happens when that hand is slapping us in the face and when the market isn't working for most? You may, and have likely already heard, people clutch their pearls over what this missing middle housing plan would do to the quote-unquote character of the city and quibble over curb cuts or how many bushes there are per square acre in a development. It's inspiring to see such sudden and ardent supporters of stormwater management. And while the city shouldn't rubber stamp this or anything else, and debate is healthy, I would argue that the character of a city isn't about the buildings, it's about the people and how they care for others. Hood River markets itself as a friendly, inclusive place where people are nice and neighbors look out for one another. Is this a marketing gimmick, or is this an ideal we truly want to live up to? And if so, are we living up to it when we're pushing working families out? I would argue we are not. This change to the housing code is a significant step in the right direction to addressing Hood River's housing crisis. It allows us to use our small quantity of buildable land more efficiently and helps make housing more accessible. I hope the city can make real progress on this issue, and I hope someday soon we will get to see the results. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. Ryan Tuohy and then Greg Crafts.
Nice.
Ryan, we can't hear you yet. I'm not sure if you need to press star six.
How's that?
We can hear you now. Great.
Okay. Thank you, all of you, for the time to speak. I'd like to start before getting into the code itself. I'm disappointed in the public notice issue, and I think that this meeting should have been rescheduled. I believe the meeting's unlawful because of the timing notice. And also, in addition to that, this entire event is contrary to city goal number two, which is inform and engage all segments of our community through transparency and proactive and inclusive and comprehensive outreach. I'd like to ask Mr. Kearns if that is going to be adequate to give me standing in the future if this becomes an issue.
Mayor, do you want me to take a stab at that or wait till later?
I think you should wait. Brian, you've made the request, and the city attorney can address that at a different time, but I don't want you to eat up your time waiting with his answer. So just go ahead and with your next stuff, okay. And we can get back to you later.
That was a yes or no. Okay. So I've been a proponent of cottage code for a long time. I think this is long overdue. This covers that and more. Everyone understands that housing here is not affordable, and we should address that thoughtfully. Unfortunately, as written, this doesn't do it. It needs some tweaks. An immediate concern is the effect of these radical changes on city goal number 3. This shows up in the likely impact of the drastic reductions in parking requirements. The second concern is that this is not going to result in much housing for residents. We do have good developers that want to do this. I'm thinking of Mike Kitts and Greg Crafts, but we all know what's happened with their well-intentioned developments in the past. So first on parking, goal 3, promote an efficient, safe, multimodal transportation system that alleviates traffic and parking congestion and encourages bike ped transportation. Everyone here has at least one car. We all know it. Please require at least one parking space per dwelling. We'll regret it if you don't. Second, so if we're going to cause harm to one city goal, we should ensure that we're getting something for it. And that something is workforce housing. I think we all agree on that. So to that, affordability, diversity, workforce housing, and the target market, except in rare cases, this isn't that solution. I think it would be instructive for everyone to understand how much the middle housing units are likely to cost and who the likely buyers will be. Planning Commission spent some time discussing that, and I think you should as well. The last time the city tried to help housing for locals, as an example, you enacted STR regulations that resulted in a significant increase in the number of STRs, especially owned by out-of-towners. So it's quite possible this will just be another round of that mess. And I'm happy to discuss that in detail. It sounds like we got a week to do it with any council member. The data's crystal clear. I've got it. I'm happy to share it with you. So some of the code provisions in this thing are great. I think there are some things we should consider, though, so that we won't just be getting more secondary homes. First, the code should be reserved for affordable and retaining homes for local residents. I think you could do that. The city has a Rand Road property and then the potential for land trust on the horizon that are appropriate and should be supported, and this code should be tested there first. I think that will also probably result in more housing for locals. This code is only appropriate where infrastructure can support it, and that certainly isn't everywhere. I sent some parking pictures earlier that kind of demonstrate that, that should be in your
package. Brian, try to wrap up, okay?
Okay. So the Planning Commission acknowledged that this code will not result in workforce housing, affordable housing, or housing for low-income seniors. The market rate housing should have parking, and these types of homes will be these should be reserved for developments like Rand Road and land trust programs until we understand how they work in a small town like ours and where we can, you know, prioritize truly diverse housing for all locals and seniors. Thanks for the time. I appreciate all the hard work you guys are doing.
Okay, Greg Crafts is up, and then Jennifer Paletto.
Hi, counselors. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. You're loud and clear, Greg.
Okay, good. My name is Greg Crafts, and thank you for working on some form of cottage housing ordinance. This has been missing and needed in Hood River for years. I'm commenting because I want the ordinance to succeed, and I want it to be used as often as possible by the building community. So I've got some specific points to that end. I know that parking would look best if it were behind the homes, but requiring this in all situations may make the ordinance a lot less used due to very many sloped and narrow lots. It also has drawbacks of more impermeable surface while creating less open space for the inhabitants of the homes. I can see situations where it might make sense to have 2 parking spots in front of the lot and 2 more parking spots in the back from the alley, but this code as written would prevent this. And speaking of alleys, our alleys are only 10 feet wide. Requiring all access to be for the alleys could quickly overrun the usage in some situations. For instance, the other day I looked at a lot that was for sale, which had an alley in back and was big enough to be split into 2 lots. If each of those then had 4 units on each lot, the alley would go from no usage to cars for a total of 8 homes, which would be quite a change for the neighborhood. Next, I'm concerned about the requirement that detached buildings be 10 feet apart. I believe fire code for buildings is 6 feet. It's hard enough to fit detached units in an infill lot, and this 10-foot rule would make it a lot harder. I'm afraid this will push the developers to create attached units, which in turn will be bigger, bulkier buildings, which will not look as good in the neighborhood as detached cottages would. And last, I feel there needs to be a plan to make sure the code will work with the building and public works and fire departments. I've had situations where planning was okay with a project, but all of a sudden the building department interpreted a fire code to mean the lot line had to be 3 feet from the exterior walls in detached housing situations. Unfortunately, this cost me not only time, but a lot from the development, which raised the prices for everyone else. Furthermore, with all access from alleys, there could be fire department problems if the units are too far from the main street. So thanks for listening, and thanks for working on this important project.
Thank you, Greg. Jennifer Pauletto, and then Tina McNerthany.
Good evening. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, we can.
My name is Jennifer Pauletto, and I've been a resident of Hood River since 2011, and I currently rent near 13th and Lincoln. Thank you all for your time tonight in addressing one of the many housing-related issues that affect the members of the Hood River community. The building code should reflect the needs of residents, and addressing missing middle housing helps do that. I've worked most of my adult life in the Gorge, and as a professional working in social services, I have never once thought that I, myself, or together with my partner could ever own a home. I recognize that my experience is one of privilege in many ways, and I want to acknowledge that I have the time and ability to join you all tonight. And though my experience is my own, I know many people who have also committed their service, knowledge, and abilities to Hood River and have a similar shared experience. All of my professional roles working with children and families have been to increase access to vital services and promote inclusive policies. I currently manage direct service staff and programming for a local nonprofit. For the last 4 years in this position, I've never been fully staffed. Most of those who work in the agency note housing in the Gorge is the primary reason they have to turn down a position or leave the area. The agency I work for loses talented staff because they note other communities will allow for building a family. Staff who grew up here and committed to return after college in order to bring their new knowledge and passion have given up doing so because living here is unattainable. Though I have also thought about leaving the community frequently, I have made my life here and I want to be part of positive change, even if I never benefit from it. In reviewing the packet for today's meeting, I noticed that one of the items that you all are here to consider is the character of the area. I consider that character every day when I go to work and advocate fiercely for clients and their needs to be met. If we're really addressing the character of the community, we need to also note that we continue to lose members of the community due to housing prices. Our nonprofits cannot hire and sustain staff, and vital services cannot be provided to community members without those who do the selfless work of social services. We continue to lose smart, innovative, and dedicated professionals, in part due to housing inaccessibility and in many different professions. If the code is not adapted, losing dedicated professionals will continue. I recognize that one of Hood River's ideals includes prioritizing nonprofits and the work that they do for our community. I'm aware that many of you here tonight also give back to the communities in the ways that you can. If we continue to keep those who uplift the community every day in a place that leaves them out of putting roots into the community, we will never meet the ideals of which we preach. I appreciate your time and dedication to this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. Tina McNerthany, and then Eddie Petroselli.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hi, how are you all?
We're good.
So my name is Tina McNerthany. I'm a Hood River resident. To start, I want to thank city leaders and planning staff for exploring policy changes to address our city's housing crisis. In the past year, Hood River County home prices appreciated 25% given market conditions. Code changes alone will not result in workforce housing opportunities. Significant subsidy, creative strategies like limited appreciation home ownership, land banking, and the like will be required, or perhaps a prohibition on second homeowners. That said, I want to address two elements of the proposed middle housing code. First, the parking ratio and bringing it from the current 1.5 to 0.75, and second, fourplexes. On the parking ratio issue, even if Hood River's population doubles or triples over time, the city will remain disconnected from Portland because of the significant amount of public lands in the Gorge. Further, the Gorge Commission has restricted the amount of land that can be brought into the UGB, so future development will be limited and Hood River's population will not grow large enough to support substantial public transit. Between 2013 and 2018, the percent of Hood River households that own two or more cars actually increased from 69.6% to 78.3%, according to the census. The mean commute time to work for adults age 16 plus was 19 minutes in 2019, and 83% of commuters traveled by a single occupancy auto. So I feel that a minimum parking ratio of 0.75 will enable developers to build homes that don't provide enough parking to meet the parking needs of more car-dependent middle-income households, but will appeal to higher-income households, including second homeowners and white-collar tech remote workers who can make it with only one car. The goal of most developers is singular, to maximize profit. If they can decrease construction costs by eliminating parking, they're going to do it, regardless of the long-term impacts on the community and livability. Another reason to ensure homes have enough parking: recreation is an integral part of the local lifestyle, and most households have multiple cars, toys, and rec vehicles. Our land use and development policies should reflect this. Lastly, in high cost of living communities like Hood River, in order to afford housing, it's common for multiple unrelated adults to live together. Multi-generational households are also on the rise. These types of households generally have two, if not three or more cars. For example, where I live on the west side, four out of our five neighbors own three or more cars. Two neighbor homes are occupied by three plus unrelated adults, each with their own car, though the homes have just one car, garage, and driveway that can barely fit one car. We have a shortage of on-street parking in the R2 zone, and this is all with mostly single-family homes and a couple of townhomes. This has created huge neighbor tensions and dangerous conditions like cars constantly blocking sidewalks. So my main point is common sense would dictate a minimum parking ratio of at least 1.0, lower than the current minimum, but high enough to ensure at least one parking space per household. Thanks.
Thank you, Tina. Eddie Petroselli, and then Mandy Whaley.
Everybody hear me okay?
We can hear you.
Great. My name's Eddie. I'm a co-owner at Big Winds Hood River and Oregon E-Bikes here in town. And, speaking in front of a city council, this is a first, but this is an issue that I think is very dear to our employees and actually for me as well. Our biggest barrier with our businesses is attracting and retaining employees. And right now, no matter how generous we are with our salaries, we can't offer employees a path to home ownership. And often just even offering salaries that cover rent here in Hood River is challenging. And for our businesses, we target very affluent customers, those who demand quality service. We're not Walmart. And our hires have to be skilled, educated, and talented. And we find it very easy to attract people to want to come to Hood River, but what drives them away is housing. If not at first, over time. Our employees struggle to look long while renting. That or a commute from neighboring areas takes its toll. But what really pushes them away, and I've heard this from other speakers, is just watching the housing prices rise and continue to rise and just feel as though there's no hope. So I commend the council here for taking on this issue. And personally, even as a co-owner, I've been here now for 5 years. I moved here at the urging of Steve Gates and naively thought that by selling our Florida home, we'd be able to buy one when we got here. And 5 years in, we're still renting. So this is something that from a personal level as an owner, but most of all for employees and someone who's on the front line of the tourism business, I do see a dynamic being fostered here in which it's very difficult for employees who in some ways feel like they want to share this area, but feel in some ways they're captive hosts, that the very people they're servicing are those who are displacing them. And having lived on Hawaii and kind of seeing what that dynamic can be firsthand, it's not one that necessarily is one that's going to continue to drive visitors to having a good time here. So in any case, I commend the council for taking this on. We are very much in favor of it, and I thank you for giving me the time to speak.
Thank you, Eddie. Mandy Whaley and Paula Chakowski.
Hi, I'm Mandy Whaley. I've been in town with my family of four for about a year. I was exposed to the Gorge in 2010, 2011, and knew this is where I wanted to raise my family. We have a commitment to our community here that, you know, we're just planting our roots, but I'd like to grow. But my concern is the sustainability. You know, I want to be a small business owner. I am a board certified behavior analyst. We are in a huge crisis of behavioral services. There's so many kids here, there's so many adults here that need behavioral support, but it's not an industry that is without cost. It takes direct care staff that can only make like $22 an hour. And I know that I can't keep staff paying them $22 an hour. And, you know, I really worry about that. And how do I sustain a business here when people can't afford to live here? Just to train a technician, which is the direct care staff, costs $6,000 up front. And 6 months for me to get the money back from insurance rates, which means that, you know, if I have high turnovers in my technicians, my business will fail and kids with autism will not have access to services. On top of this, I see plenty of young professionals, talented clinicians, especially occupational therapists, that are having to leave the Gorge because they can't afford housing here either. Occupational therapists are doctorate level clinicians, and they want to leave and go to Nevada because they can afford a house there. And then maybe they can come back and afford to buy a home later. So it's just heartbreaking to me to see such a need for behavioral health in our community and know that housing is a big reason why I can't help supply it. It also breaks my heart to know that my kids, as it is in this trend, we'll never be able to establish their own independence here. This is generationally not a sustainable situation. If I can't buy a home, then my kids aren't going to be able to buy a home. I won't have a home to you know, give to them. So how are they going to enjoy the, you know, this wonderful place that they've called home as they move into adulthood? You know, I'm not a policymaker. I'm a clinician. I'm an aspiring business owner. But, you know, so please do your best. But I know that these townhomes work. I live in one on Columbia Street. It's beautiful. It's aesthetic. There's plenty of parking. But what breaks my heart is that I'm the only long-term resident here. And I know that for a fact that I'm paying almost $1,000 less in rent than everyone else in my block. Why? Because I happen to have a landowner who appreciated that I worked with the autistic community. So it's luck. And it's luck that I'm afraid that I can't sustain. And what happens if it goes away? Oregon has some of the lowest reimbursement rates for what I do. And, you know, it's not like we can just move into a $1 million home or can buy a half a mil fixer upper. Or buy the house that we're in. So, Mandy, you know,
Mandy, can you wrap up?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
I'm an essential worker, and I want to bring more essential workers and talented professionals into the community. I want to provide jobs for younger kids aspiring to help other people. And this bill would help that. And thank you for considering it. And I'm sorry I wasn't on time. It was really short notice, and I didn't have time to write a beautiful draft like everybody else that presented tonight. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Mandy. Paula Chakowski.
Try again.
Hi.
We can hear you, Paula.
Great. Sorry. Thank you. And like Mandy before me, I didn't prepare anything, so kind of shooting from the hip. But my name's Paula. I have lived in Hood River since 2009. I have a bachelor's degree. I work as a nurse in our emergency department. I was very fortunate to be able to slip into a tear down virtually home 5 years ago, which really I can't afford to live in. And I rent it long term. And I rent an apartment further out of town that costs me less than my mortgage. A lot of the nurses that I work with have been waiting for affordable homes for years and they can't afford it. We do know that a couple nurses in EMS got in on one of Mike Kitt's last neighborhoods. And Greg Crafts, I know a lot of people that live in his builds. I think what you're doing, Dustin, the plan that's come up, everybody that you've been working on, you're getting closer. It's so close, but it's really not, it's not enough of a cap. Like, there are hardworking, well-educated people that are needed in Hood River to keep this community rolling in the way that we all have learned to love it. And it's not going to happen if we keep pricing us all out, including the grocery workers and our gas station attendants and our coffee makers and all our waiters and waitresses. I think we can do better for everybody. So thank you for all the work you're doing, but I think it still needs a little bit of work.
Thank you, Paula. That's all the people we have signed up for this evening. So now we'll go ahead. Does staff have any specific questions, or excuse me, does council have any specific questions for staff? We will not go into deliberations this evening, but mainly clarifying questions, I guess, is what we would do this evening if anyone has anything. We had a work session on this, basically a couple of these before, so we're getting, honing this down further and further, but it's not in stone yet. Does anyone have any questions for Dustin? Tim has a question. Go ahead, Tim.
Thanks, Mayor. So this is a question for Dustin. So Dustin, in some of the public comment, it was suggested that the Planning Commission had come up with a scenario with respect to the issue with parking in front of, in between the development and the street, of requiring 50% of the required parking to be in the front setback, provided it was less than 36% of the frontage. Can you comment on that?
That was an idea that was floated out in Planning Commission. It did not receive consensus, or it did not receive a majority of it. So it was an idea that they did discuss, but it wasn't one that had a majority of Planning Commission. And so when I initially drafted for your workshop, that was it didn't include it as their idea. I think I represented that aside from the draft and the comment, they did not have consensus on how they would handle that parking issue. So that was an idea that was discussed. It didn't receive a majority of Planning Commission's buy-in.
So what is your feeling on that particular scenario?
So the current code right now, as drafted, allows one parking space per dwelling to occur in the front yard setback. Mm-hmm. And I believe I mentioned that code is a little more suited to a single driveway scenario where we have one garage and you could park in the driveway. If we're starting to talk about one curb cut with, and I think that was the council consensus, really trying to limit those number of curb cuts to preserve some of that on-street parking, preserve the street tree, not break up the sidewalk, becomes a lot more difficult to start adding the number of dwelling units on a lot and using the driveway. Driveway really has to remain open unless you become that neighbor that blocks the driveway. And so the idea, when you look at this, if you have to pull a car off that driveway, you really start eroding the front yard. In our 5,000 square foot lots, you could pretty much assure that you're gonna end up with, and I think the mention was 36%. If you put a car in the front yard, you're gonna end up with you know, anywhere between 30% and 40% in a parking space in a front yard. If you add the driveway, you're going to end up in certain configurations up to 60% of the front yard being paved. And I think that starts having a pretty significant liability when it comes to trying to encourage some what industry refers to as gentle zoning, and really trying to stick with some of the hallmarks of this traditional neighborhood design that really kind of is an idea of scale and compatibility. I mean, my staff recommendation was to limit it just by virtue of trying to promote this house forward, front porch, community forward design and de-emphasize the use of and the prevalence of off-street parking. So I could manufacture something for you and I can provide you some analysis on how what the percentages were for your discussion, but that's where kind of a short summary. Sorry, it's probably too long of a summary, but
that's okay.
That's some summary.
Thank you for the detail. There was also a comment related to this issue that suggested that there may be some lots where it's just not feasible to do the parking as is written in the code right now. Can you comment on that?
Yes, I would agree that there are some lots that would not be eligible for this because of their topography, size, and orientation. I think that's, writing a code that I don't believe it's going to be possible to write a clear and objective code that fits every single scenario. I think that's the unfortunate thing. I do believe we want to see this code used, but it's not going to fit every site. And I think, not to rely on a variance, but there are those options when are the circumstances unique enough that that the code doesn't fit. And the code contemplates variances. But certainly, hopefully, the code drives people to the sites that do work. I mean, that's another part of it is here's the scenario, here's the guiding principles and policies. Hopefully, that helps pick the site selection where this becomes the right tool for those sites.
So do we have a feel for how many sites would be excluded given the topography?
No, I would say we don't have a feel for that. Generally speaking, I could probably pick certain characteristics that, it really depends on how far are you willing to go to make it work. I mean, I think there is more, is it practical? I can guarantee it would work on all of them. Does it become financially feasible or practical? That becomes the telling question. Are you willing to put in retaining walls? How much dirt needs to be moved? What are the street conditions like? How much infrastructure is already in place? Those are going to be the financial factors and that really start driving these things. It can be difficult for on-site layout, but I wouldn't have a number of sites that this becomes that doesn't work for.
Yeah, thank you. So I guess just in general, just to kind of conclude that this line, I suppose for me, do you think that precluding parking in front of the house will result in more or less housing?
It makes it more challenging. Certainly, I think it's a challenging design standard. And I think it's one that is, again, it goes to the idea that if we're anticipating and programming a greater number of units to be built on these lots, anywhere between 50% and up, there are measures to be taken to hopefully build that compatibility and maybe offset some of that. That increase in units by better design. I think that's the trade-off.
Thanks, Tessa.
I have one clarifying question. Does anyone else have any questions or clarifying? Okay, Megan, go ahead.
Yeah, Dustin, I'm wondering if you could speak to, we had a comment about the fire code spacing is 6 feet. Is that true, or what would be the legal minimum?
It will depend. It's the building code, so you can pull the international building code. It's not going to say 6 feet, so it will depend on how many windows you have, your fire rated construction, what are the encroachments. So it's a varying degree. It's not going to be a hard and fast number such as 6 feet. When we introduced the code, we put in 10 feet. That becomes a pretty safe distance. You also heard the idea that and the concern that, well, is planning going to allow this and we're going to run into building code problems? Well, I think we've introduced a code that in that building spacing that helps prevent that. It's going to should allow construction types that aren't necessarily higher in the fire rating. It should allow windows. It should allow architectural features. It's going to allow some encroachments, and hopefully in the end, we don't end up with a space that becomes useless. I mean, that's part of it too, is it's not only just fire code, it's also building and designing spaces that become useful for people. Can you put a barbecue out there? Can you have a deck? Can you have a patio? Can you put a ladder on your own yard? I mean, that's, you have a two-story home and you have 5 feet to work with. It becomes a challenge for maintenance, and that's also comes into that separation. So I could tell you, if we're within 3 feet of that property line, if somebody splits the property line, you're going to have serious fire code issues when it comes to unrated openings. If you get beyond that, we start expanding that opportunity and we're allowed those architectural features we're trying to promote. So it's not a completely straight answer, but certainly once you get within, if you have 6 feet between buildings and you have overhangs, you start triggering fire code issues. So we want to, I would rather be cautious and make sure that we provided that window and some space to work with. So.
Dustin, I have a question on, it's on page 24 and 25 of our packet. It has to do with existing dwellings, and it's under accessory dwellings, common buildings, existing non-conforming structures, and accessory dwelling units. So it says that you can add cottages onto a lot that already has an existing dwelling, correct? Okay, you're saying yes, okay. And then under number three, which it says existing dwelling units, it says existing driveways and parking may remain, but if expanded or modified, not more than one parking space may be allowed in the front yard setback. So if we have a house that's 20 feet back from, it has a garage that faces forward, it has, you know, this driveway into the garage, so you can park in that space in front of that garage, but you could put some cottages on the back of that lot, correct?
So in building four, or item two and three, it considers the incorporating, the first one incorporates the use of a house and adding cottages, basically adding in density and not requiring that house to all of a sudden be downsized to the point where it meets the 1200 square foot. If we're looking at site changes, that would most likely trigger the new standards. So if you're changing the driveways, that would be something, it would have to comply with the new code. If you're leaving the driveway in place, detached, untouched, we would allow that to remain without having to come in compliance with the code.
But you would have to take that out. I mean, it's an existing dwelling, existing driveway. It's been that way, compatible with the neighborhood. But you would have to take that out if you put cottages on the back. Is that what you're saying?
If you changed it. If you decided to change that access to serve other accesses, you started redoing the site around it, would have to comply. But if you didn't, if it remained in place, it could stay in place.
And okay,
that would be, it would kind of like, it would refer to it as like the touch rule. If you don't touch it, it can stay.
Okay. If you had an alley access off the back, well, there's one of these examples that was sent to us. There's alley access off the back. There's a house that has access off the front. Would you have to cut off that access in the back? Or excuse me, off of the main street in the front, if you were going to have other dwellings that came off the back?
You would add, I believe you would be adding, if you're adding dwelling units to the back, you'd be accessing off the back.
So the front house can't access from the front anymore?
It would stay. It could stay as is.
That was my question. It can stay as is. You can access off the front for that front house. and then add these other dwellings in the back and they can access off the alley.
Yes, I believe that's the intent, to hold the kind of it, that's in line with kind of keeping the character, you know, utilizing the character. It's been built. That is what's expected, I believe, and as written, that's what it should represent. Keeping okay. that and encouraging the preservation of that house, or even okay. the conversion of that house to multiple units.
Okay, so that's what number three, page 25, number three, the last sentence, that's what that's saying. I just wanted to clarify that. I couldn't get that quite straight in my head. Thank you. Megan?
I want to build off of that, because if you don't have an alley, you would presumably have to add more parking for the new units you're adding in a conversion. So you would always be touching the driveway. So would you always have to remove it in any scenario where you don't have a back alley to access from?
If you're going to touch the driveway and redo the site to where we have conversions, I believe that is that would have to be reconfigured to comply.
So outside of an alley scenario, it seems like every single conversion would require more parking, and therefore we would be actually removing the existing parking.
It depends on the scenario. I guess you wouldn't necessarily have to touch it. If you had a garage in a single family home that had a rear garage and a rear detached driveway, which is not too uncommon in a traditional neighborhood, you would most likely be able to queue the cars to the back and provide that. I think I looked at a number of houses on Columbia when we were doing a look at Columbia, which is traditionally difficult to park on the south side, and how they have provided driveways that comply for houses that were built at the turn of the century and retrofitted to comply with this. So okay. In that respect, if we were going to touch the driveway, start adding units, we would be looking for compliance with the parking standard.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Mark has a question.
Yeah. Dustin, you mentioned the variance process. Could you outline, I mean, if we had a site on a steep hill and they wanted to come in for a variance, or someone wanted to put the units closer together and they were willing to make design stuff so that was safe, how does that work? And is it, how does it not be complete non-starter for the development community?
Well, it certainly is a bigger challenge if you're going to look for waivers from the rules. I mean, because at that point, you know, we do go before a public hearing, but that's where you make your case on why you're unique and why you have a practical hardship. But the way it would work is you would have your request, you would cite the criteria that you could not comply with and build your case around it on why you have a unique site, a unique hardship. And that would be presented before Planning Commission, who would render a decision on it, or render a decision that could be appealed to you. So, but it goes in front of a public hearing and they are allowed the opportunity to state their case. So be it topo, topography, be it a natural feature, trying to avoid a wetland, trying to preserve trees. These are all reasons, practical design reasons that we could entertain.
Eric?
Thank you, Mayor. Yes, I had a couple of questions. First was...
Eric, can you get closer to your speaker? You're kind of underwater.
I apologize. Is that better?
Great. Yes.
Thank you. So, Dustin, I had two questions. First, my first question is, through the Planning Commission process, I am just wondering if there was any testimony from maybe Public Works or anyone of that ilk, engineers, et cetera, that might address any concerns about, or potential concerns about infrastructure capacity. I'm thinking in particular of maybe the sewer line, but there may be other issues as well, or is that could result from increased density. Just sort of what's, wondering what the historical analysis or factual inputs have been on that question. So that was my first question. Maybe I can just give them both if that's okay. My second question relates to STRs. I had the sense from a comment a couple of meetings ago that we weren't concerned about these new units being used as STRs for a certain reason. I just can't put my finger on what that was. I wonder if you could remind me of that.
Thank you. In terms of the water and sewer, there's a provision there that talks about requiring compliance. For the most part, if we have compliant water and sewer features, really the number of units aren't really going to trigger a change in that. The size of the public water mains really serve up to those units. I didn't have Public Works testify in Planning Commission, but something that we discuss when it comes to this many units, there will be circumstances where there's required to be frontage upgrades to comply, but in terms of system-wide, you know, the number of dwelling units is typically on par with our minimum, or it should not be exceeding our minimum water and sewer frontage utilities out there. I spoke with the building official and conferred regarding a number of the standards internally as well as fire. In terms, but they weren't necessarily Public Works forward, or excuse me, Planning Commission forward discussions. They're really more staff discussions when building the draft code. On the STR side, I think one of the main issues, this was something I failed to mention in my report, and it was something I wanted to bring back up. Currently, there was a Planning Commission prohibition recommendation in the code itself. It's actually on the page that the mayor was discussing on page 24 of your packet, or excuse me, 25 of the packet. We had some concern about that recommendation just out of administration in terms of citing these houses that will be owned as far as and administering the unique set of restrictions that apply to them. One of the issues we that kind of reduces the sense of urgency on this is that in order to have a short-term rental license with any of these that occur within the residential zones, they would have to be owner-occupied or primary residents. That would not change for this use. You would still have to be a primary resident. You would still have to meet the parking requirements in order to get a license. Those STR provisions are in place now. There was also, we got a little testimony regarding these may be the owners that are on the cusp who may necessarily need this extra money or this extra income in order to get into this entry level market. So that is something you may want to just rely on your short-term regulation license and take out of the zoning code if you see fit. But this is something that it's lawful to remain in there, but we have some concerns about how would we create a new class of houses, creating really kind of a disadvantage of this class of houses away from the base zone. So.
And with that, I'm sorry, I could just follow up question with respect to the STRs. So, and I see now the section 5, it seems to just flat out prohibit it. But how does that work with respect to commercial zone 1? Because I think we have a greater liberality of use of STRs in commercial zone 1. So if there is one of these cottage clusters built in commercial zone 1, section 5 says it can't be used as a short-term rental. So would that then control, and then it just would not be allowed to be used as a short-term rental?
Yeah, so in the C zones, C2 and C1, there's not a residency requirement. They would still have to meet the parking requirement. That's the way the legislation was written for in Title V regarding this. So that would be an instance, if this section was taken out, you would be able to have a short-term rental without your primary residence in the C1 zone. it's definitely a minority of the number of cases that we have in terms of development. But if you saw a development under this code occur in there, they would be able to have those as short-term rentals without having it be their primary residence. I'm sorry.
Okay. And then back to my first question on the infrastructure question, maybe ask a slightly different kind of more basic way. Do you have any concerns about infrastructure throughput that could result from taking advantage of this code in maybe existing neighborhoods that have older pipelines?
I do, but not because of this code. So I think we just have old infrastructure. I don't think this necessarily changes the need for that investment for infill development because the number of units. I think we just have, if you look at our stormwater plan, the INI plan that is coming through, those are just, regardless of infill development and density, those are just infrastructure issues, even at the base zone level. I think the city manager has just chimed on and was going to, oh.
I have nothing to add to that.
Thank you.
I'll add a question for you, Dustin, on to Eric's question. So even if it was, even if a dwelling was put in a C1, even if a cottage cluster was put in a C1, depending on how much parking there was, it might make it very difficult to license a short-term rental, even if the owner didn't live there because of the parking regulations. Is that true? If we said, yes, it's okay in the C1.
Yeah, this came up also, that's correct. So you still have to, there's nothing in the zoning code that all of a sudden preempts the parking requirement for a short-term rental out of the license. And that similar conversation came up when we talked about fee in lieu, as well as historic conversions downtown. For buildings, you still have to meet the parking requirements in order to get a license. There's nothing in the zoning code that preempts that licensure requirement.
Okay. Additional questions for Dustin? I don't see any hands. All right. So we are not going to deliberate this evening because we may have additional people that want to speak after we extend this on, and we will probably be receiving or maybe receiving also written testimony between now and our next public hearing on this subject. So and we need to take in all data before we get into a discussion on it. So do I have a motion about continuing this to a date certain?
Tim's been raising his hand. I don't know if he wants to.
Who was raising their hand?
That would be me and Mayor. I assume that we'll still have a chance to ask Dustin questions next meeting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
This was just to get some of the questions you might have had in your mind so far clarified a little bit more before next week, so we can be thinking about those some more.
Mayor, I've talked with a number of you already, so thank you for continuing to send me questions. I'd be happy to take them prior as well if you wanted some clarifications. It actually becomes very helpful when it comes to testing this from a non-planner lens. You know, we read it like planners. Sometimes these, you know, it may be, it's really helpful when you start looking at it and putting it under a microscope under some of your non-planner looks, because this, it's really important for this to be clear and objective. We want to avoid any kind of disputes that we end up, and really commas, punctuation, order of words can be really, can really matter. So I encourage you, if you do have questions the way that it reads, I invite you all to talk to me and ask that ahead of time. You may have questions that other people have too, or you may read it opposite, and those are great cues that I've gotten already. When two of you read the same section and come away with different explanations, that right there signals to me that I need to do some language revisions for everyone's benefit.
right, great. Tim?
So just one clarifying question for Dan Kearns. In the context of the hearing, Dan, is that okay to do that, those questions?
Yeah, this is a public, we have pretty liberal procedures for two reasons. It's a public hearing and it's a legislative matter. And mm-hmm. so it's super important to get broad public input. That's why when faced with a request to cancel tonight's hearing, there's no legal reason to do that. And I thought that in fact was a bad idea given the objective of getting more and broader input from the public. So yes, that includes even taking public testimony at the continuance hearing and as many questions as the city council wants to ask of staff.
Thank you.
Could I get a motion to continue the hearing to the 15th of March? And we have some other subjects that'll be happening that evening. So I don't think, and Rachel, can you confirm this, that we probably wouldn't start that hearing prior to 7 p.m.?
Mayor, that could be correct. Certainly, we could plan on doing the utility rate work. That's what's scheduled for the 15th, first thing at 6 o'clock, and then move into a hearing at 7 o'clock. That would be fine to set it for a date and time certain.
Okay. Thank you, Rachel.
I'm happy to try and make a motion. I guess, is there specific language I need given the public hearing aspect? Maybe Dan?
What you would be doing, I think, is continuing tonight's public hearing to 7 o'clock on March 15th, keeping open the record for unlimited public comments on this proposal during that entire period, and then also allowing more public testimony at the hearing on the 15th. Is that what you're shooting for?
Sure.
How does that, are you comfortable with that? Okay, then I would say that would, a motion with those elements would do the trick.
Okay. Well, then I will move to continue tonight's public hearing until March 15th at 7 p.m. or later. And to keep open the record and allow public testimony on the 15th.
All right, I have a motion to continue tonight's middle housing file number 2020-37 and ordinance 2061. That's a continuance to March 15th, no earlier than 7 p.m. The record will be open for written testimony and also for additional oral testimony on the 15th. Do I have a second?
I second that.
All right. Megan has made the first and Gladys has seconded that. Roll call vote. Megan?
Yes.
Jessica?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
Eric?
I would go further, but I'm an aye to this motion.
Okay. Gladys?
Aye.
Mark?
Yes.
And chair votes yes. All right. Our public hearing is now continued. All right. We're going to go ahead and open the work session. Do we have any agenda additions or corrections?
No, Mayor, we do not.
Okay. We have a discussion item that we're going to have a presentation. So Will is going to introduce that.
Thank you, Mayor and City Council. So we have the second of three meetings on utility rates. Last meeting was on water sewer rates, and tonight we're going to focus on stormwater rates and SDCs. So we have the FCS folks on the line to give us a presentation. See Doug And so I'll, without stealing any of their steam, I'll hand this over to Doug and be, and I'll stick on to answer any questions at the end.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Doug Gabbard with FCS Group. I am joined today by Wyatt Zimbelman, who is the other Doug Gabbard you'll see on the screen. It's not really another one of me, it's Wyatt. And also John Ghilarducci, principal with the firm. I am now gonna get these slides into presentation mode. Can you see the slides and my moving cursor? All right, we are good to go. It's stormwater, the second of the three presentations in a row. Tonight we're gonna talk about stormwater SDCs first, and then moving into the rates. And a little bonus with the rates is we're gonna talk about rate credits, which can be a little bit of sugar to make the medicine go down. And we'll talk more about why you might be interested in that. And then we'll touch on next steps before we wrap things up. This has been a big engagement and we're getting near the end. With regard to water and sewer, we are done. Stormwater is tonight and next week is affordability. I have seen that presentation already. I think you're going to find it fascinating and that will wrap things up for this engagement. So let's talk about the stormwater system development charge, and we'll begin, because this is the only SDC conversation we're having with this engagement, let's go over a few basics of SDCs. SDCs are one-time charges. They're not ongoing rates, so nobody pays a monthly bill for SDCs. There are five services where you're allowed to charge SDCs, and they are listed in that second bullet, and stormwater is one of them. SDCs are for capital only. You cannot use SDC revenue for operating expenses, and therefore you cannot collect SDCs for operating expenses. SDCs can, in theory, have both an existing and future component. In other words, the SDC can be based on a portion of projects in the future and also a portion of assets that you have now, when we'll talk more about that. SDCs are for system facilities, not local facilities, where you might choose a different financing technique, such as an LID. The reason you have a consultant help you with SDCs is the law is very specific in a lot of ways, and we are familiar with this law, ORS Chapter 223, known as the SDC Act, and we keep you on the right side of it. If we start getting into the math of SDCs, there are two main components of an SDC, or up to two. One is a reimbursement fee that is the eligible, emphasis on eligible, value of unused capacity in existing facilities. So this would be existing assets to the extent that they have capacity to serve future users, divided by the growth in those users. And so you end up with a nice little unit cost of your existing assets to the extent that they have available capacity. In the middle, you see the improvement fee. Now that's what people normally think of when they think of an SDC. You have a project list, and every project has an eligible portion that will be used to serve future users. And those eligible portions for each project are added up. And then you divide that by that growth in the system demand. And you put together the reimbursement fee and the improvement fee, and that is the total system development charge. Drilling down a little bit on that growth in the denominator, the first step is always determine, well, how are you going to measure growth? And with stormwater, it is very common to measure growth and demand in equivalent dwelling units based on impervious surface area. We're going to have a lot more to say about this with rates, because you don't currently charge rates that way, but you do charge SDCs that way. And so that won't be much of a difference. The way that you start the calculation is you determine how many of those EDUs, in other words, how much impervious surface area do you have now? What do you expect to have in the future? And the difference between those numbers is your growth. Well, we happen to get really good data from the city on the impervious surface area in the city right now. And so we were able to really make an accurate calculation of your current impervious surface area and dividing that by a standard 2,490 square feet per EDU. That gives us a good solid EDU count. We have then a growth assumption of 1.4% per year, which leads us 9 years later to 7,874 EDUs, or growth of 926 EDUs. And so this 926 becomes the denominator in the SDC calculation. Now, reimbursement fee is based upon, as I said before, the eligible capacity in your existing system. That information about that typically comes from a master plan. Well, you'll have a master plan that says, okay, here is the city's existing system, and this part of the system is not yet being fully utilized, and we would really hone in on that and try to quantify that, because that sounds like that's available capacity that that new development could be asked to buy into via a reimbursement fee. But we don't have that data, and so at this point we don't really have any basis to justify a reimbursement fee. So there will be no reimbursement fee in this SDC calculation. But you do have projects, and projects are the basis of a reimbursement fee. And so we are able to calculate an improvement fee. There are 18 total projects with an aggregate cost of about $7.3 million. With the wonderful help of staff, they went through each project. We gave them kind of the definition of eligibility and what eligibility means, and they looked carefully at the project list and they assigned an eligibility percentage to each project. In aggregate, that comes to about 35%, and so your total eligible projects are about $2.5 million. So now that's going to be in the numerator of the SDC calculation. So let's put it all together. You have a total project cost of about $2.5 million. You have a fund balance of about $145,000. Now, since you've already collected this and you haven't spent it on projects, we're going to deduct this from your cost basis because there's no need to collect it again. So you have a net cost basis of about $2.4 million. We're going to divide that by that 926 EDUs, which gives us an improvement fee of $2,581 per EDU. We have a compliance fee, which is specifically allowed by law, and we inserted in this category essentially the cost of doing the SDC methodology like we're doing right now. You are specifically allowed by the law to collect that in your SDC. And so we added that in, and it comes out to about $26 per EDU. And so a total calculated SDC of $2,607.52 per EDU. And another way to say that is $2,600 per single family residence, since single family residences are by definition one EDU. So where does that put you? Well, a single family residence right now would cost you $733 for SDCs in Hood River. And if you charge the maximum, that would quickly put you at the top of this list. This list may look a little shorter than the comparisons that we showed you for water and sewer rates. Not everybody charges a stormwater SDC, so that's one thing to keep in mind. We do also want you to keep in mind that just because we calculated a maximum defensible SDC, you are not necessarily obligated to charge the maximum defensible SDC. This number should be viewed as a ceiling, and you are free to charge anything up to that amount for no reason or no findings necessary. We did in the case of stormwater specifically, we did do the rate analysis on the assumption that you would be implementing the full stormwater SDC, but that really won't make a ton of difference either way because SDCs come in over such a long period of time. But that is the SDC analysis, $2,608 per EDU. And now we're going to move into the revenue requirement, which is another way of saying the rate analysis for stormwater. And for that, I will hand it over to Wyatt.
Hey, so this is a familiar slide. It's the same stuff that we looked at as assumptions for water and sewer. So we're going to have some annual cost inflation. We're going to apply that to your budget. We're going to forecast customer stats and revenue. And we're going to use that with that 1.4% growth rate. And again, just reiterating what Doug said, we are going to assume it just for this analysis that the SDC revenues are based on the full adopted SDC, the maximum SDC. And then just a reminder too, on the debt side, if we do include debt in this analysis, our first source of debt is going to be an interfund loan from the equipment fund. And if you remember in the sewer analysis, we assumed that we were going to borrow about $1.5 million and there was $4 million total available. And so the first $2.5 million of debt would come from the equipment fund. Everything after that would then be assumed to be revenue bonds. So this is the capital funding forecast. Again, same kind of thing looked at for water and sewer. So this is the, you know, each year's capital projects and how those are being funded. Upfront, the waterfront storm line project is being funded through external funding. The city is not paying for that. But then after that, the projects are being mostly funded through debt. And that is to kind of help us cushion and limit the rate increases. So the assumptions that we have there are interfund loans in fiscal year 23 and 25 of $1 million and $1.5 million. And then revenue bonds in fiscal year 24, 25, fiscal year 27, and then fiscal year 29. So kind of how that bears out in terms of a forecast of rates. Again, this slide is showing your operating expenses in the dark bar, and then you've got your existing debt service there in that green. And then you can see the new debt service, and then the purple color, that's gonna be, you know, cash being made available for capital projects. So by the time you get to 2029, the new debt service has made up a very significant portion of the cost of the utility. And to cover that cost, and that's that dotted line going across the graphs, we're assuming 14% rate increases for the next 4 years. And then after that, you can jump back down to 3%, which is in line with the water and the sewer forecast. So we're going to look at the existing rates that you charge right now. So for the stormwater utility, this is the existing rate schedule. It's a flat monthly rate based on each customer's meter size. This is kind of similar to what you'd see on the base fee side of a water rate study. And, you know, although there's a kind of a relationship between the size of a customer's meter and how they impact the stormwater system, how much impervious surface area they have, it's not necessarily the best measure of their impact on the system, not necessarily the best way to measure how much each customer should pay. And to kind of give a good example of how that looks, right now there is about 80% of the revenue for the system is being collected from the single family customers, and they only make up about 45% of the impervious area, according to GIS data. And then this is another example of kind of the inequity that you'd see in that kind of rate. And this is just taking a hypothetical example of, you know, three very large commercial customers, and they all have a 6-inch water meter, and they all pay the same thing for stormwater. But those customers could have very, very wide range of impervious square feet, very large differences in the size of their lot, and they would be impacting your, you know, stormwater system very differently, but paying the same amount. So now let's talk about, you know, what this recommended rate structure would look like, and that would be an EDU rate-based approach. Again, equivalent dwelling unit EDU is going to be one single-family equivalent, and that equivalent is 2,490 square feet of impervious area. And then all other parcels other than single-family, they would be measured in EDUs, which would be their impervious square feet divided by 2,490. So to get to that number, that 2,490, we actually were provided full GIS data of every parcel in the city. And so we got the actual average parcel in terms of single family impervious area, and that is that 2,490. And then just to kind of give an example of how this would work, again, single family, no matter the size of the lot, no matter the amount of impervious area, single family is always going to be one EDU. And then a commercial customer, it would be based on, again, on that count of their impervious surface area, which the city would have information on. And then you divide that by that 2,490, that gives you the number of EDUs, and that's what they'd be charged on for a minimum, at least, of one EDU. So the reason this is a preferable structure is that it's going to align the revenue that you collect with the impervious surface area. So again, we looked at that kind of 80-20 split right now versus the 45% that single family probably should be paying based on impervious area. And so going to this structure would help align the revenue collection with the actual impervious area of the system. And the way that works to get to that rate is we take that revenue requirement. So that's the amount of revenue we are projecting to need to collect in next fiscal year. We divide that by, again, the count of EDUs that we have. And that gives us both an annual and then a monthly rate per EDU. And how that looks right now, and keep in mind, this is with a 14% rate increase assumed, you would actually see the rate for residential customers go down. So one EDU, that rate is actually more than $2 below the existing 3/4-inch meter single family. For most single family customers, that's what they would pay. Most residential customers would see their rate go down. And the flip side of that is that, commercial customers, especially larger commercial customers, would then bear more of that cost. Now, Doug's going to talk a little bit about some rate credits.
So what we're about to share with you here is an optional add-on to what Wyatt just shared with you about the rate. So those rates can stand on their own just fine. But your larger customers are going to get hit pretty hard on kind of the double whammy of the rate increase that we talked about earlier, and then the shift to an impervious surface based rate. Though that's going to be a double hit for large commercial customers. One way to help that or make it go down a little easier is potentially a rate credit scheme that can be offered to non-residential customers who mitigate their runoff in a way above and beyond the city's minimum standards. And so we wanted to lay out for you kind of what that could look like. The details of the standards is something that would have to be hashed out, but we wanted to show you kind of what the financing of that would look like and the revenue impact and how the rates would shift as a result of that. So the method for figuring out a rate credit is basically to take all of the costs in your revenue requirement and allocate them into two different buckets. And the words that you see here are base costs and use costs. Different words we might use are unavoidable costs and avoidable costs. Yeah, in other words, there's costs that we call use costs that have to do with costs that potentially could go away if you didn't have runoff to handle in the system, and base costs are those fixed costs that you're going to have no matter what. And by figuring out what goes where, we can then begin to figure out how much of a credit you can charge if that credit is based mostly on avoidable costs. So the idea is the non-residential customer does some mitigation that helps the utility avoid costs, and those avoided costs are then passed on to the customer in the form of a rate credit. So let's put some numbers to this. So if we allocate out your revenue requirement for next fiscal year, about 60% of those costs are in the base category. In other words, they're unavoidable, they're fixed. And about 40% are based on the use of the system and the flow being put through the stormwater system. So we might call those theoretically avoidable costs. So here's how we do the calculation. We have these dollar figures for base and use that we just saw. And we're gonna take the base costs and we're gonna divide them by your total customer base, a little over 7,000 EDUs. We're gonna take your use costs and we're gonna divide them by a slightly lower number of EDUs because we're gonna assume, and this is a guess, an educated guess, we're gonna assume that you're gonna lose about 10% of your non-residential EDUs to this credit system. In other words, we're going to assume that 10% of your non-residential customers will qualify for a rate credit. And so we're going to divide that by a smaller number, which gets us a slightly larger annual rate here. This is monthly rate times 12, essentially. So the sum of these two is $94.27. Now, $94.27, if you divide that by 12, you don't get $7.67. Instead, what you get is $7.86. And so, in other words, if you're going to have this credit scheme, and if you're going to make a 42% credit available, which is what it turns out to be, then your rate per EDU will have to be bumped up a little bit to $7.86 rather than the lower rate that we just shared with you a moment ago. So the maximum credit available would be 42%, and you would still get your entire revenue requirement if the EDU charge was raised to $7.86. And if I may anticipate a question that you might have here, you might be wondering, Doug, you've just been talking about avoidable costs and the mitigation actions of your customers making things easier on your utility and your utility passing on the savings to the customers. Why does the rate have to go up? Why is it not just a wash, pun intended? The reason, it's a great question because I had that question myself. The reason is, in large part, they're going to be getting credits for things that they are already doing. So these are mitigations that are already baked into the system. And so they're not actually going to be doing anything different than they're already doing. And so we're going to assume that you're still going to need the full revenue requirement, that no savings are going to necessarily accrue to the utility. And so that's the reason why the EDU has to come up a little bit if you're going to offer a rate credit. So that's the analysis. The next steps are affordability analysis is going to be presented to you next week. When you are ready to roll out the stormwater SDC, you want to give a 90-day notice to interested parties before you have the public hearing for that. And it doesn't stop the city council from thinking about it, but you cannot take official action until that 90-day notice is complete. And that is what we have for you. And we'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, I've got a couple hands up. Let's, Mark, go ahead first and then Megan.
Thanks, Doug. And Doug, that was good. First question is on slide number 12, it says there's $7.2 million worth of projects. And on slide 17, it says $14 million. And are those different millions? Or maybe because waterfront doesn't fit inside that 14.
So this might be, and I'm going to ask Wyatt to kind of open up the model and see if he sees anything. This might be a funding source issue because this is the city funded portion of project cost, but I'm going to give Wyatt a chance to open up the model and see what's going on.
Now, maybe if there's just an answer forthcoming, that works. My bigger question is, you know, you talked about the use costs in the 42% max credit, mm-hmm. but we didn't talk about how does a property earn those credits.
Yeah, because that's the hard part. That's why we didn't talk about it. So John, I know that you've set up these credit schemes in a bunch of different places. Can you talk about ways that developments can exceed city requirements?
It really does come down to a policy threshold that the city sets. And the fundamental question is, do they get a credit for meeting your development requirements, or do they have to exceed the development requirements in order to get that credit? And so that might be building, you know, on-site retention larger than required for their property alone that might be usable by others, or upsizing the conveyance in front of their property to the benefit of the public system. And it has to be of system benefit and acceptable to the city in order to earn that credit. But there is the details of how you craft that threshold really have to be tailored to the city's own requirements. So we haven't answered that specific question.
One of the general rules is that we are only talking about non-residential properties, because those are the ones that really have the potential to move the needle for the utility. You don't want to hire a bunch of city staff to go around chasing every house's rain garden, because that just administratively you would spend more than you save.
Okay, so that's on us as the city, I guess, to figure out what that is. So that makes sense. One last question, please, Kate, and that is: does the SDC rationale that's envisioned allow the city to include square feet of the house or impervious surface square feet differently? So, you know, you guys are just listening to the cottage code stuff. Can we incent those smaller footprint buildings over, you know, a super large house with a big driveway and you know, very little impervious surface on a site? So does SDC allow us to play with that variable the way it's written?
Yeah, you can if you want. We find it is administratively easier to just say a house, all single families are in this category, but we understand the way that the wind is blowing, and if it's worth it to you to vary it, then by all means. I mean, the SDC, you could take this SDC that we've calculated, $2,607, and you could divide it by 2490, and there is your per square foot of impervious surface area charge, which is exactly the way you would do it for commercial, but you could also do it that way for residential. I saw that John wanted to get on this.
There are a couple cities at least that do that. Corvallis does, for one. Going into it with your eyes wide open, I think, is important, because it does lead to the question, when then a single family residence adds to their footprint via a patio or a deck or a bedroom, you know, any kind of expansion, by that methodology, you should be charging them an SDC for that additional impervious. So it you know, I mean, the city could decide not to do that, but it does lead you down that path, I guess, which requires some additional tracking.
But the methodology that's published and approved by the state would give us the freedom to get in as much trouble as we want to.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
And so, Counselor, before we leave you, why do you want to chime in on the project costs?
Yeah, so the $14 million that was shown on the rate part of the presentation, that was with cost escalation, so with a 3% a year construction cost inflation. This is in present day dollars. And then there was the $5 million that's for that waterfront line, and that's the non-city funded portion. So that's why it's the $7
million. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Wyatt.
Megan, did you have a question? I have
two questions, if that's okay. One, the stormwater stuff doesn't have the 5-year graphs that our ones last week showed, and I know there aren't the different customer classes, so it's a way simpler thing, but could you say, like, if we're doing 14% increase, what the rate would be per EDU in 5 years?
Oh, we certainly have that information. And yeah, in fact, Wyatt has the spreadsheet open. I'm certain of it. And he's going right to that worksheet as we speak.
So, so you're saying, you know, maybe at the end of the 4 years of 14% increases?
Yeah, I'm just thinking, so last week we had for water and sewer, there were the really nice little charts of this is how it's going to grow for different, and it was, you know, way more complicated with different customer classes and different rates for each customer class, but I'm just wondering what that would look like in this scenario.
Yeah, I mean, if you go out to be fiscal year 24-25 when the 14% increases are wrapped up, you would be up to $11.36 per EDU.
Okay, awesome. Great. And then probably more in the MARC realm of getting us in trouble, but a more broad question of, and maybe this is also for Will and folks, but do we ever have a scenario where, whether it's a house or a non-residential development, does on-site treatment and doesn't need to connect to the stormwater system and therefore wouldn't need to pay an SDC?
That's going to, if Wade or Mark can answer that. They're on.
They may not connect directly, but in most cases, there's always going to be the need for an overflow for larger events to a city system.
Okay.
We don't, I think the answer to that is we don't provide any way to get out of stormwater SDCs for anyone.
Okay.
I can add one thing to that too. Sorry to, if I may, the EPA in defining a municipal storm system includes the city streets as part of that system, because they provide conveyance of stormwater runoff. So even if you're not connected to the hard pipe system, you are still connected to the streets and they are part of the management of stormwater runoff. And also your property is protected from runoff from other properties because of that, the presence of that public system. So you're a beneficiary of the system, even if you're not directly connected.
Okay, thank you.
Jessica?
Yeah, thank you. Great presentation, like last week. One question. So I had the rate credit where you talked about it has to, it assumes that the credit's for what's already happening. What about in the future?
Right.
If we had some, yeah.
So that 42% would still be a valid percentage. So by that time, their mitigation would, their that future mitigation would allow you in theory not to escalate your operating costs perhaps as steeply. So it would be felt in the operations of the utility, but the 42% would still be the right credit percentage.
So if like a brand new customer is coming online and they're developing their facility and they put in extra stormwater detention ponds, we would give them a 42%
yes
credit.
Okay. That is how we would envision it working.
And then the other question, I guess maybe this is a question for us. I'm just thinking about, you know, last week with the water and sewer and this with the stormwater, especially thinking about our non-residential customers and how much a lot of this is going to pile on top of them. I know one of the things that was suggested last week was, I think it was in water with multifamily, where you, instead of decreasing, so my idea was, instead of decreasing single family dwellings, what if we just left everybody the same to slow that increase for the non-residential customers? Does that make sense?
You could do that. So essentially you would have, what that would mean is that for at least temporarily, you would have different costs per EDU for residential and non-residential. And you know, maybe that would be okay as a transition strategy, but we would certainly want you to get as quickly as possible to an EDU as an EDU.
Okay.
I get, you know, one of the nice things about stormwater rates in that EDU approach, which is the industry standard by far, is they're simple, and that would introduce a level of complexity, splitting the rate so there was one rate for single family and one for commercial. I think, as Doug said, you could do it, but it would make them more complicated and I think probably less defensible, because there's really no cost basis for distinguishing commercial impervious from residential impervious and charging them different. One of the tenets of stormwater rates is every square foot of impervious is the same, basically. So it's a great question. I think it would be pretty complex for the stormwater rate.
I think I would add to that, Councillor Mehta, too, is we've sort of specifically tried to unburden the non-residential with water and sewer, and we did that quite a bit. So we are certainly, and those rates are, if you look at the bottom line, are the majority and the bulk of their charges. And stormwater is still pretty minor, except for when you get into be a very large property, and those are typically large corporations. Mm-hmm. And for many of these, I would say local downtown folks, when we get to an impervious surface calculation, that actually benefits them. So if you're thinking that all non-residential are hurt by switching to impervious surface, it's not really the case. Kind of those small downtown compact folks may actually see a slight bit of benefit out of this.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else with questions? I don't see any additional questions. All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Complicated subject, but you guys make it as simple as it can possibly be with complicated formulas and explanations for everything. So, and thank you for the presentation in our packet so we could kind of get a feel for, you know, what you were going to present tonight. Really appreciate it. And looking really forward to the affordability discussion next week. So we will see you next week.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. All right, we're going to adjourn the work session and open the regular council meeting. Do we have any agenda additions or corrections?
No, Mayor, we do not.
Okay. We only have one item on our consent agenda, which is the council meeting minutes from February 22nd. Could I get a motion for that if people have read those and are okay with those?
I would move we approve the consent agenda.
Second.
I have a motion from Megan and a second from Jessica to approve the consent agenda. Any discussion? All right, roll call vote. Mark?
Yes.
Gladys?
Aye.
Eric?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
Jessica?
Aye.
Megan?
Yes.
And chair votes aye. All right, we have approved the consent agenda. No other, any regular business items at all? No, okay. All right. And I guess nothing pressing from department heads. We've had planning already. I just want to check in with Chief Holste and Chief Damien. Do you have anything this week?
Nothing for me, Your Honor.
Mayor, I have not heard that Chief Damien does either.
Okay. Okay, great.
Nothing for me either, Mayor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chief. All right. Mayor call. I don't have anything except that I'm just excited as all heck because I get my COVID vaccine on Thursday. Yes. My first one. So that's pretty exciting for me. I don't have anything else this week. Things are going well. Bi-state working group is, I think we're going to have another meeting in a couple weeks. But I'll just let others go. Megan?
I don't have anything this week.
Gladys?
Thank you, Mayor. I do. I just want to recognize that today is Happy International Women's Day. And to all of you lovely ladies on this call, thank you so much for all that you do. I saw something today that it just really spoke to me, and I just want to read it out loud. It says, here's to women raising babies, women raising ourselves, women raising each other, women raising our hands, women raising the bar, women raising access to glass ceilings, women raising glasses, women raising and rising and rising. So to all of you lovely ladies on this call, and all of you listening that are ladies as well, happy day to us all, and thank you for all that you do for our community, for your families, and for each other.
Thank you, Gladys. Mark?
I'll just second Gladys's applause to the International Women's Day, and I don't have any, I'm not feeling clever enough to add anything on top of that, so I'm good.
Jessica?
Nothing for me today, Mayor.
Okay, Tim?
Ditto, nothing for me this week.
Okay, Eric?
Nothing for me either, thank you.
All right. I just wanted to thank Rachel for getting Kenny and Elisa. That was a very informative part of our continued learning about what's going on. So thank you so much. And I think part of that came out of our homeless work that we did over the winter. And it definitely came out of that. And part of that was money that came from Providence. So thank you to Providence. And then the city taking the bull by the horns, so to speak, and getting Alyssa to help through the winter. And then now she's with Mid-Columbia Community Action Council. So thank you for help making that happen, Rachel. Appreciate it. I think that's all we have for this evening. We're going to go ahead and adjourn at 8:58. See you next week.
Appreciate your time.
Good night.
Good night.